sound is.
I think it's safe to say that today's episode is one of our most requested ones, and with good reason too, isn't it, Nick?
Definitely, Tom, it is. And for all those guests out there, yes, you can stop writing in and tell us to do an episode on this.
Stop emailing us, stop messaging us, it's happening.
We're doing it now.
That's it. We're going to be talking about the Greek genocide today, and it's significant on a number of levels, not least of which because the results of it have helped to shape the makeup of the Greece we know today, with communities like the Pontians, Thracians, Armenians, Assyrians and more being shifted to Greece based on their Christianity. It's a huge story, isn't it, Nick?
It's a massive story, and look, it's got to be told. The longer we go on, there's generations that don't know the story, or they might know it at a high level, but at least we've got people today that we're going to go into depth, and perfect opportunity for me to ask all these amazing questions that we've been severing for.
True, and I count myself among those people that need to be educated a little bit more on this topic. It's a story that takes place in the early parts of the 20th century, World War One and its aftermath, and we can't do it justice without an expert, which is why we have one of the best authorities on genocide sitting in the room with us. And Nick, you're the one who managed to get him for us, aren't you?
I did, mate. I'm not being biased, but he comes from an amazing part of Greece as well. So
no bias at all. No
not
bias.
Being biased at all. Hint, hint.
Okay, well, let me introduce him to you. Our guest has been active in the field of genocide studies for over two decades. Since 2000, he's been the Vice President of the Australian Institute for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. His research interests revolve around the Hellenic, Armenian, and Assyrian genocides, particularly the Australian and international eyewitnesses and relief efforts on behalf of the survivors of the deportations and massacres. He holds a research doctorate in genocide studies, where his thesis was titled Hellenism Under the Crescent, a case study in an ongoing genocide. He's a university lecturer and regularly talks at community events on these areas of interest. Joining us in the distillery today is Panayotis Diamandis. Welcome to Ouzo Talk, my friend.
Nasta kala. Thank you for the invitation and for the drinks.
Of course. Yeah, we do have a number of drinks here. But more importantly, Nick, how does it feel to finally have an ipiroti with you?
Mate, what are we, 30 episodes in? Maybe 40. More? 40?
41, lost count. I think it is.
Finally, we got one. I keep on telling you how good we are, but we finally got a... You know, a well-distinguished, he's a doctor as well.
He is, actually. Do you prefer to be called doctor, or do you leave that out of your title?
In writing, yes, but when speaking to people, it's just Panayotti.
Good stuff. Well, on that note, Nick, what do you reckon? Shall we kick it all off?
Let's kick it off, mate. Let's have a drink.
Yamas.
Yeah.
Cheers, boy, this.
Panayotti, welcome. And Nick, what are we drinking today? What's on the menu?
Well, what isn't on the menu, Tom?
There's a few bottles here, let's be honest.
Look, we did start off with Vekaraki.
Just you and me. That was band prayer, podcast prayer, rather.
It was, yeah. But we ran out, so we're on this Cretan Sikoudia. It is very cold, actually. I was going to say, it's actually, what do you call it? For the Lemur, we started nicknaming this.
Yeah, we've said this in the last few episodes as things have started to get a little bit colder nowadays here in Sydney, but it's what Angelo Tsaruka's auntie said.
Okay. That's right.
That's what we're sticking to.
Yeah, so we're having medicine, Sikoudia medicine.
That's right. And actually, on that point, a few months ago, there was some brand out there that brought out a Sikoudia or a Tsipouro or something like that, and they actually branded it by saying the real COVID vaccine. I just thought that was brilliant.
Well, they're probably not far off the truth there. This stuff does kill everything.
It does. It does. Including brain cells, apparently. Yeah. According to George Paxinos.
Yeah, thanks, Paxinos. Destroyed our drinking habit.
Anyway, so there's a few things on the table. We've got Tsipouro, we've got Sikoudia, there's mini, there's roots, there's even sparkling water. What are you having, Panayotti?
Being a true ipiroti, I've gone straight for the Tsipouro.
Good stuff.
Or Kritiki Sikoudia.
Close enough.
Which I nickname my Yasmos, but some people get offended by that.
I think that's truly justified.
Classic.
But yeah, look, we have to thank at this point our sponsors, flymenow.com.au. You would have heard everything in the intro anyway, but thank you to you guys for being on board. Make sure you check out their website, flymenow.com.au, for all your travel needs. Right, Nick?
Well said, Tom. Poppy and a team, they're waiting for you guys to reach out to them. You can even get her via WhatsApp and get out there, guys, and support our people that support us.
Absolutely. So, on that note, Panayotti, mate, tell us a little bit about your Greek background. Where are you from?
Well, you've already mentioned that.
Yeah.
Well, half anyway.
Koryo then.
My dad's family are from a Koryo called Eliniko. It used to be called Lozetsi. It's just south of Yanina, so in Ipiro. And my mom's family is from around Agrinio in the western part of Greece. Fantastic. So both mainlanders.
Were you born here or were you born overseas?
Born here, but I'm one of the yo-yos. In the 80s, we moved back.
Okay.
Well, we moved.
Yep.
With the plan being that we stay there. Mm-hmm. A few years later, we came back and... The heart's still there, part of the heart is still there, and the body's here, and just keep bouncing. So pre-COVID, I was there every year, but with COVID, I've only been back just this year was the first time.
Okay.
So first time in 4 years.
Where did you go back to? Was it Epiro or Athens or any particular?
Kala standard Athens, Thessaloniki. Yanina for sure, Stohorio. This trip was really just out of nowhere. I ended up in Alexandroupoli just for a day trip. Those of you who don't know Greek geography very well, it's about 400 kilometers east of Thessaloniki. So we left in the morning and came back in the evening because the Pontian Federation had their board meeting out there. So I said, okay, yeah, I've got nothing better to do on a Sunday in Thessaloniki by myself, so I'll join you guys. It was a great drive. Lots of banter, lots of discussion, and a bit of research as well, which I will get into my research later on.
And it is a great drive up there, really. Like, I've done
with
it
the
a
new
few
roads,
times.
Yes.
It's absolutely beautiful, you know, passing a lot of these. I think it may have even been apricot trees or something up there, something along those lines.
Yeah. Especially around Veria, there's lots of apricots and other stone fruits. Then you go towards around the back of Chalkidiki, lots of vines. Then you go along the coast for a bit. Then you go inland, and it's just it's like Balkan countries, like mountains and rock and forest. And you cross these big rivers, and then you go back into the coast and through the plains past Komotini.
Yeah,
and you suddenly see minarets, and it's like what. Is this Greece?
Really?
Yeah.
It's surreal. I've been a number of times. I'm used to it.
Mm-hmm.
But you cross the Nestor, the river, from Ceres into Nomos Xanthis, and you suddenly start seeing minarets next to our churches.
But we have minarets in Yanina, I guess. But are these used?
But now they're just used for stork, like Aluchani and around beyond the Platia, which is used just for storks nesting. No, these are actual functioning mosques. They're Muslim. They're either exclusively Muslim or Muslim mixed Christian villages.
And this is an important point because they do still exist in Greece, don't they?
Yeah, there's about 120,000 in that part of Greece Muslims.
Is that right?
Yeah. About half of them Turkish origin. A number of them, about a third, are Pomaki. They speak their own language, Pomaki, which is a mixture. It's a patois of old Slavic, Greek, Turkish. Now a bit of English is moving in. It's
so these are the Pomaks that we're talking about.
They don't look Asian. They look completely blue-eyed, blonde, fair-skinned. They're European.
Sure.
And, of course, you've got the Romani or the Tsigani, some of whom are Muslim, some of whom are Christian. But it's a very diverse, very mixed area, particularly Xanthi and Komotini, the cities. You feel like you're more in Asia Minor than in Greece, than in mainland Greece.
Okay, wow.
The food, the smells, the sights, it feels more Eastern than it does like anything like Yanina or Thessaloniki or... Tom, where are your people from?
Corfu.
Oh, you're next door.
From the
neighbours.
No, completely different to anything on Kerkera.
Just one quick boat ride from where we need to.
I've never been, by the way, but yeah.
Oh, we've got to remedy that.
Skimmer rock there, eh?
That's it.
Yeah.
Very interesting, yeah.
So do they speak Greek there as well?
Yeah, Greek's the language that everybody uses.
Okay, so they don't speak their own dialect, or they have
it as a second
language.
As well, and that creates real issues because the Pomaks, for example, are forced at school to learn Greek and Turkish.
Yep.
But at home they speak Pomak. But in the shops, they speak Greek. And their education level, therefore, is... Actually, it's rubbish. Most of them don't finish high school. Most of them don't even barely finish primary school and then end up as farmers. And that part of the world, the land is not rich. So it's tough. It's a tough living.
And how close is that to the border of Turkey?
Komotini is about an hour and a half on the freeway.
Okay.
120-odd kilometres. In a straight line, it's not... It's here to Wollongong. In a straight line. But because of the mountains, the road has to curve and go do all sorts of things.
Yeah.
But in a straight line, it's here to Wollongong. And there's the Evros River.
Mm.
Like Alexandroupoli is 40 kilometres.
Wow.
So here to Parramatta.
Yeah.
And you're in a different country.
Yeah.
This is something we in Australia, unless we've travelled, a lot of people don't understand, that you leave Thessaloniki, in an hour you head north, you're in Bulgaria. You go a couple of hours east, you're in Anatoliki Thraki. You go up from Yana, you go an hour north, you're in Albania.
Mm.
Or Vodiepiro, but anyway.
Yeah.
You're in different countries.
Definitely. Particularly for us in Australia and our listeners in the US, where we just think like, man, we could be driving for days and still be in the same country. Or when relatives come from Greece and they're like, oh my God, we traveled so many hours and we spent 5 hours flying over Australia.
Yeah.
And we're still not there.
Yeah.
it's a different mindset.
To go across the States, because I've done it once, I went to a conference it was 10 years ago, in Miami. And from San Fran to Miami is 6 hours.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's similar to us with Perth.
Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy.
So Americans can kind of, when you put it in that context, they kind of get an idea that continental US is the same size as Australia. It is massive.
Yeah. I think we've said in other episodes, Greece is the size of 2/3 of New South Wales, which is one
2/3.
State.
No way. It's less than that.
You reckon?
Yeah. It's a little bit bigger than Victoria.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's tiny.
Or 2.5 Tasmanias.
Yeah.
Okay. So seriously. It's a new unit of measure.
But that puts it in context.
Yeah, it is. It's not a big place.
We're not speaking, but we have lots of mountains
we got to go around, so distances do increase.
But this is why all our, just like with Australia, all our cities, all the major cities in Greece are all on the coast. This is why Greek Hellenic civilization has grown up around the sea. Mm. It was simply the easiest way to get around. And for today's topic, our cities in Asia Minor, our cities in Thraki or in Pontus, they're all on the coast.
Because of that reason.
For that reason. There's only a very few isolated spots, usually on rivers, which are inland away from the coast.
Yeah, true. Well, I mean, that brings us nicely towards where we're heading with this discussion. But before we get into the real nitty-gritty of the topic, let's start with the basics. What's a genocide for those who don't really understand?
I'm not going to give you the textbook definition. You can simply Google it. Really simple. It's the organized plan by a government or a government-like group of people. It's people in control to get rid of, to destroy another group of people because of who they are. We don't like them because of their religion. We don't like them because they're ugly. We don't like them because they play football the wrong way. Whatever the reason is irrelevant. Genocide is a crime. It's a law.
Mm.
There are laws against it that have defined it and outlawed it. The defining feature is what is the intent of the person committing the crime. If you intend to destroy all these people, that's genocide. Doesn't matter if you kill one or you kill 100 million. The numbers don't matter.
Mm.
What is the intent is the defining feature. And that's the really, really, really short version.
Okay, so in a nutshell then, give us a high-level view of what the Greek genocide we're talking about actually was. What's the elevator pitch of what that was?
It's the organized attempt by the governments of the Ottoman Empire and the Republic of Turkey afterwards to eliminate anyone that was not Turkish.
Right.
Or they saw as Turkish. That includes ethnic Greeks, ethnic Assyrians, ethnic Armenians, but particularly non-Muslims.
Right.
So there are other groups like the Yazidis who are neither Christian nor Muslim who were targeted. Jews were not targeted at that time simply because they only really were in concentrated numbers in a few cities, so they weren't a threat. So once a group was reduced to 5% of the population of the district, the killing stopped. Because at 5%, they were not considered a threat. They'll just walk away, die away, be assimilated, who cares? They're no longer a threat.
So what were they considered a threat? So what is the reason behind this?
This goes back to the 1800s, well into the 1800s now.
Yeah.
What we need to remember is that what we call Greece
mm-hmm.
was a number of provinces of the Ottoman Empire. So it was ruled by the Turks. So Yana fell in about 1300 and something,
mm-hmm.
right? Close to 600 years. So this was what they considered their territory. 1821, a group of nutcases come along and start a revolt. This is another episode altogether, but contrary to common myth, it never started in Peloponnesus. My apologies to the southerners. The first fighting of the revolt was in what we now call Romania. Some fighters, a few thousand, organized themselves, what is now Ukraine, crossed the border into what was then the Ottoman Empire, today's Romania, and launched the revolution. This was in February of 1821. And a number of these people were what we call Pontians. So the Ypsilantis family were originally from Pontus, but they didn't use the name Pontian. They used the name Mavrothalassites, usually what they're known as. And the revolt was eventually successful, thanks to the great powers. Out of the Hellenic War of Independence, we get the Greek community of Australia. The first Greeks to settle in Australia were Palikaria to Ekousiana. They were freedom fighters from the War of Independence.
Is that right?
Who were exiled out here. They arrived here in 1829, here being Sydney, 1829. And they were the first documented, confirmed. There are reports of earlier ones, but they're the first documented ones.
And these guys were convicts, were they?
They were convicts.
Wow.
Yeah, they were convicts. There were seven of them at first.
Were they Cretan? Cretan pirates?
No, they're from Ithra.
Ithra.
Okay.
So for those of you who know the ancient, you know, Argos, the ancient city of Argos,
yep.
One of the cigar-shaped island off the coast of Argos. Bubulina, Las Calles Bubulina, that island near Spetses and those islands around there, which today the day trippers from Athens go.
Hmm.
That's where they were from.
Okay.
Arrested as pirates, convicted, and sentenced to transportation. Seven of them, as I said, after a few years, I'm cutting it really short, all seven received absolute pardons, so like they never committed a crime.
Mm.
Five chose to go home. One disappeared in a shipwreck off Brazil, survived the shipwreck, but we lose all trace of him after he gets onto land. The other four, we lose track of them once they get to Kerkira, which at that time, of course, was British.
Really?
It was British. So we know that they got to Kerkira, and where they went after that, don't know. We lose trace of them.
What a story. Could be your ancestors, mate.
Could be.
I don't think so. But anyway.
Or the Mithras.
Maybe.
The other two stayed in Australia. Mm. One settled and spent the rest of his life in Picton, outside Sydney.
Mm.
And the other one made his way down to what we call the Monero District. So where are the Snowies? On the other side, the other mountain range on the left. And spent the rest of his life. He ended up having married, had 10 kids.
Unbelievable.
His descendants were everywhere. Vulgaris. The one in Monero is Yikas Vulgaris. We know where his grave is. It's been restored by the community in Canberra.
Mm-hmm.
In a horio called Nimitabel. It's 2.5 hours south of Canberra. So it's closer to Victoria than it is to Sydney. And the other one was Andonis to Manoli, which became Andonis Manolis. But it's actually hilarious. You look at it in the archives, in the convict records, and it's Andonis T-O-U to Manoli. Seriously.
In Greeklish.
In Greeklish. This is the original Greeklish.
Wow. It was back then.
1820s.
Yeah, so everyone stop blaming the internet age and text messaging.
Oh, it goes way back.
It was way back then.
Classic. And we did touch on this in our last episode too, didn't we? Coming to Australia.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, no, that's a fantastic segue.
So when the War of Independence succeeded in 1830 with the Greek state, it triggered then revolts amongst the Bulgarians and the Serbs and a bunch of others, and slowly bits of the empire were breaking away and forming new states. By the 1890s, and especially by the Balkans Wars, which is when Yanina was liberated, half the empire was gone, and they're like, what are we going to do here? We the rulers, are going to be left with nothing. So the plan was formed to wipe out everyone that was not Muslim, because then Muslim Kurds, Muslim Albanians, the others could be Turkified, because they're already Muslim. But the non-Muslims would not convert anymore.
Right.
So that's why they were a threat, and therefore had to be gotten rid of.
Let's dispel this one thing then. Successive Turkish governments basically has in the past consistently used rhetoric about Armenian and Greek treachery, aggression, criminality, territorial ambitions. Is there any easy way to dispel that? Or at this point, does it purely become a case of he said, she said type of thing?
When you have government documents from Congress meetings, so the government of the Ottoman Empire having meetings in places like Thessaloniki, not just Konstantinopoli, but in Thessaloniki, which is where the party, that political party was formed, the Committee of Union and Progress, they called themselves. İttihad, to use the Turkish word for committee. And the documents are spelling out, first, you start by disarming them. Second, you take away their financial resources, economic boycotts. Then you decapitate the community. Then you get rid of the fighting age men. Then you get rid of the women and children. This was spelled out. This is 1910, 1911.
Wow.
The killing doesn't start till 1914. And this is all documented. These records exist. I've used them.
I mean, why Thessaloniki, though? Is that because Ataturk was born there as well? Mustafa Kemal.
That's another, talking about myth busting, that's one of the myths.
Oh. Okay.
Kemal was born in a horio outside Thessaloniki in Langadas, behind the ridge, called Chrysavie. His father was an Albanian tax official, low level tax official. His mother was from what we will call Voriipiro, Greek speaking. Both of them, simply because the population of the area was mostly Greek.
Yeah.
So they learned Greek just to be able to communicate. I think, I can't prove it, but I suspect that her family was originally Greeks who had converted to Islam because she was European. She was not one of the Anatolian Zebeide. And there's actually a story that after the Mikrasikitika catastrophe, she would Kemal would send her Greek prisoners of war from around Thessaloniki, and she would interrogate them about what's the city like, because she'd left it like 30 years before. Do you know this person? Do you know that person? How, what's that neighborhood? Because by the time she was an old lady, she was well into her 70s, which for that generation was old. But Thessaloniki is where that political party was formed.
Okay.
You've got to think, the way Paris was for the Bolshevik Revolution, you know, it was where all the foreigners, all the spies, all the exiles would all meet and just talk and have coffee and plan and scheme and plot. That was Thessaloniki for the East.
Okay.
That's where everybody gathered. It was the most important, after Konstantinopoli itself, the most important port. All the trade from Serbia, Bulgaria, Romania, all came down the river valleys to Thessaloniki for export. The number one source of tobacco for cigarettes was from Kavala and Thraki. So okay. There's lots of money floating around. There's lots of consulates. And where there's consulates, you've always got spies and espionage and la, la, la, la, la. So that's why...
It was there.
Yeah. That's why this party was formed there.
So this political party... Are we talking about they ended up... What is it called again? Were they the Young Turks? That
nicknamed the Young Turks.
Okay, so this political party took over and ran...
1908, there was a coup and they became the government.
Okay. And back then, you've got... Or you've seen evidence...
I've got it. I've got copies of them.
Wow, okay.
Summarised minutes of their meetings.
Mm. So do the Turks recognise the genocide?
No. Let me rephrase that. The Turkish state does not.
Mm-hmm.
There are groups outside the country that have officially apologised, particularly in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of academics and scholars inside the country that have
acknowledged it.
It's hard to acknowledged it, but then they have to leave because to say openly in Turkey that you recognize these genocides, you're actually breaking the law. It's illegal to insult Turkishness. It's Article 301 of their constitution. You cannot insult Turkishness and to accept...
But is that insulting them?
It's all in the eyes of the beholder, my friend.
Yeah, okay.
By their interpretation, the predecessor of these governments, so 100 years ago, the Ottoman Empire committed genocide, is an insult to Turkishness and therefore it is a crime. And there is an MP still in prison for doing this, Garo Panoyan, who, as you can tell from the name, is Armenian, but he was elected with the Kurdish party, the HDP.
Yeah.
And he's still in prison for that, for saying in on floor of the parliament that this we need to face the fact that this country committed genocide.
Okay, so in saying that, from what I understand, there's only a handful of countries that recognise the Greek genocide.
Mm-hmm.
The Armenian one, there's like dozens of countries.
Mm-hmm.
Why is there a difference? Is there a difference to genocide? Why they recognise one and not the other?
That again comes down to history. Armenian activism for recognition goes back to about 1965 when they built the memorial in Yerevan in then Soviet Armenia and started agitating around the world for political recognition of their genocide. We had other issues. You got to think, what happened after the genocide? Okay. Things started to rebuild, and then you get the Great Depression. Then you get the Metaxas dictatorship. Then you get World War II, the occupation of the country, all that catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And then being Greek, we want to get our wars out of the way altogether, so we do a civil war straight afterwards. We've never really, as a society, as a people, dealt with the civil war traumas, let alone the ones before.
Mm-hmm.
You think about it. Half the civil war was fought around our Horia. I could tell you, I'm not going to say it on air, but some of the stories my dad told me about the stuff, because he was born, his earliest memories were of that period. My dad's 1940s baby.
Yeah, so is my dad. Yeah, I've got some stories too, but you're right. It's not for air.
They're not for on air anyway.
No. Yeah.
But as a society, we haven't dealt with that. We haven't dealt with that trauma.
Yeah.
And then you get, after the civil war, then you had the junta of 67. Then you had the invasion of Cyprus, new traumas to deal with. So the genocide period has been swept under the carpet, and it's not really until the 80s, 20 years, a whole generation after the Armenians have started, that our people start, some of the Pontians start agitating for recognition within Greece.
So what about the... Yeah, no, you've summed it up perfectly. You've just done the whole history.
I'm doing...
No, it's great high level. But I guess my point is... So was it the diaspora that started the revolution.
The push to be able to recognize.
The push recognition.
It really started inside Greece. The first major leader, Michalis Haralambidis, former PASOK MP, academic, still alive. He's quite elderly now, but still alive. In the mid-80s, and this is where the diaspora comes in, he doesn't start agitating in Greece. Mm-hmm. He goes straight to the UN. Some of the earliest publications about agitating why it was genocide and why it should be recognized internationally by Haralambidis, we're talking about 1984, 85 now, open letters, basically essay-length letters, to the UN, to the US, to the Europeans, because Greece had just joined the EU back then. Greece joined in 81.
Okay.
So trying to then, through the diaspora, get Athens to do it, to acknowledge this page of its history that, not deliberately, but it had neglected, simply because other traumas were piled on top.
Yeah.
Because we don't do things in half measures.
We're Greek.
A drama, yeah. Aren't we?
Absolutely.
Look, I'll tell you one thing. A lecturer, it's 1991, we're in a lecture theatre in a lecture room in Sydney Uni. Long-haired brat of a student there called Panayoti, second-year student, thinks he knows everything, asks this new guy from Greece, this new lecturer just arrived from Greece, this is the beginning of the Macedonian issue starting to bubble up, 1992.
Yep.
1991. This conversation was in Greek. What is the best proof that we are the descendants of the ancient Greeks? Without batting an eyelid, with half a second thought, Ganon, what you see is Malakias. this amazing,
that's such a good answer.
This amazing lecturer from Greece just comes out with this little, me, the little Australian-born kid, is like, what the hell did he just say? Did he just swear? And he goes, what are you talking? I ask, what are you talking about? And he goes, look at it. What do you want? Civil war.
Yeah.
Asia Minor, 1821, where the Roumeli is fighting with Peloponnese, or who's going to rule Greece when there's no Greece yet to rule.
Yeah.
Trojan War, Byzantine, Peloponnesian War. What do you want?
That's such a good response. Yeah, yeah. Who was it?
Vras.
It was Vrasilas. So another one of our other guests, Vrasilas Karalis, who was on the Zorba the Greek episode.
And it's like, it won in five words, you've just summed up 5,000 years of Greek history.
It is unbelievable.
Wow.
I expected language, culture, traditions.
Insight.
The simplest way.
Cut through. He reminded me of Alexander the Great cutting the Gordian knot.
Yeah.
How do you, this massive rope and twine and all this, how do you untie it? Just cut it up. Just slice it open with a sword. Done.
Classic.
I was just dumbfounded. So, and 32 years later, I still talk about it.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Okay, well, how did the Greeks get to Asia Minor? Can we start from before we get into the nitty-gritty of the genocide, can we start right at the beginning? How did the Greeks get there? Were there types of Greeks? I understand there was the Caucasus Greeks, the Pontian Greeks, Cappadocian Greeks, and there's...
We're going to go way before all of that.
Okay.
We're going to go back to what we call prehistory, technically.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Prehistory is really simple. Stuff that existed, that happened, but we have no written records for. Writing had not been invented yet.
Okay.
So we're talking pre-2000 BC. Talking about 4,000 years ago. The Trojan War was effectively a Greek civil war.
So the Trojans were Greek. Trojans Greek?
The Trojans were Greek.
Really? I didn't know that.
Some of their allies weren't, but the Trojans were Greek.
Just another city-state.
Another city-state.
Respect.
Now, we can talk about Helen of Sparta and all the rest of it, which is... I love talking about going back to myth-busting. I love deconstructing the story about Helen and how she ran away with her lover and all the rest of it. Sorry, guys. Little problem here with that story. If she ran away with her lover and betrayed her husband... First of all, as a Spartan queen, yeah, right. Second of all, why did the Spartans have a temple to her and her husband 1,000 years after this event? If she ran away with her lover and was an adulteress?
Interesting.
Let's not get the fact. Let's never let the facts get in way in a good story.
Oh, keep on going. So you're saying she was kidnapped?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Wow. And was it a real story?
Where's Troy? It's like all mythology, there is a bit of truth to it. Where is Troy? It's across the straits from Gallipoli.
Mm-hmm.
Why'd the Anzacs and the Poms and everybody else go to Gallipoli in 1915? What was their target? To crack open the defences to the imperial capital, Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
Why did the Greeks go to Troy? to crack open the trade route to the Black Sea.
Same, same.
Business.
Mm. Yep.
Que te sigues malakias.
Because what did the Greeks need from the Black Sea that Greece didn't have? Mm.
That's your new T-shirt now, isn't it?
It is.
Well, we've got to put that on a T-shirt. Yeah.
That would sell like hotcakes.
Absolutely.
I can see it on the front. Garometisivies and on dot, dot, dot. And on the back, Malakias.
Malakias.
We'll put that on with the Tode Best T-shirt as well.
See. What were the Greeks importing from what we now call Russia and the Caucasus? Mm. Timber.
Right.
For ships. Grain. They couldn't grow enough grain of their own. They were importing it. Even back then. Mm. From what we now call Ukraine, the Caucasus, mm-hmm. they were importing grain and exporting the same stuff we export today, mm. olive oil and wine. Mm. And this is 4,000 years ago.
Wow, so 2,000 BC. And were they considered Greeks then? Did they speak the Greek language?
Really simple. Ancient Greek? Really simple. Mm-hmm. They worshipped the same gods. Not with different names, with the same names. Mm. So
we're talking about the Bronze Era?
Yeah. Bronze Age. So this is after Minoan Crete after Santorini blew up.
Right.
Or Thera, to be more mm-hmm. precise.
Yeah.
After that blew up, destroyed the Minoans. The Minoans are a whole episode by themselves.
Mm. I get the feeling we're going to have you on again, but...
Anytime you feel like it. As long as there's Tsipouro, it's okay.
Yeah, we've got to get Ipiro di Kotsipro, right, Tom?
Well, it's summer now. One of you's got to be going to Greece this year. I can't.
We're both going.
I'm 2 weeks away, mate.
You're 2 weeks
I'm
away. Really good. There. Your job is to make sure there's a bottle of Ipiro di Kotsipro.
We've got good sponsors. We'll have to talk to them.
We know that the Minoans had colonies on the coast of Asia Minor.
Yeah.
Still debate whether the Minoans were Greek or not, mm-hmm. because we don't have enough of their writing, Linear A, as it's been called. We don't have enough of it to say definitively it was Greek. It looks like it was. But we can't say for certain. We don't have enough evidence of it. Mm. We do know the Minoans had colonies in what we now call Israel. We do know that the Minoans had colonies at the top of the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. Wow. Not near the Nile Valley because Egyptians wouldn't allow it, but out on their borders.
In the Sinai, Red Sea?
No, on the Mediterranean coast of Sinai.
Oh, okay.
Controlling the coastal route because you can't go inland. There's no water.
Mm.
So the trade route... If the listeners take away nothing else, take away one thing. You cannot study history without studying geography.
Mm.
Absolutely cannot.
Great point.
Were the Minoans also the Philistines?
The Philistines were a branch of the Minoans.
Right, okay.
Philistia, which became Philistine.
Yeah.
How do you say Palestine in Arabic?
Yeah, there you go.
Philistine.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yep.
The Arabic name for Palestine is Philistine.
Mm.
The phil gives it away.
Yeah.
That it's
friends. Philly. Yeah.
That it's the Greek origin. Their pottery, the archaeology, all the rest of it. The Philistines were a branch of the Minoans.
Mm.
Now.
But we can't confirm the Minoans were Greek.
No. Okay. I think they were. Mm-hmm. But there's not enough of their alphabet surviving to... Not enough of their written documents surviving to say, yes, definitively, yes, they were Greek.
Mm.
The eruption happens, destroys the Aegean Basin. We're talking about 1650 or so, 1700 BC, where we get what we now call Santorini. Everyone knows it's a volcano. It's still an active volcano. It is, it's not dormant. Yeah. So those of you who are visiting Thera, be careful.
Definitely, because they've still got measurements there to measure.
It's an active volcano. It's still...
Amazing research is being done there on volcanology and all sorts of things.
Oh, it's one of the world centres for volcanology. Those of you who are brave enough can take a submersible down. Mm. Maybe it's a bad thing to say now, but it's not that deep, so.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on it with Peter Demayers.
Nice.
He talked about it, so.
So they started the Mycenaean, what we call the Mycenaean, so Agamemnon and his lot. That is a British invention. That name is a British invention. They didn't call themselves that. But anyway, they start colonies on the basically trading posts on the mm-hmm. coast of Asia Minor, mm-hmm. starting with Smyrna and Miletus, which we know of from Hittite and Assyrian records as Miluatu.
So who are Hittites? Are they
They're one of the local peoples of what we now call Anatolia, modern Asian Turkey.
Do they still exist?
No.
Okay.
No, they died out. They were assimilated as Greeks and Armenians long ago.
Mm.
Like... couple of thousand years ago.
I do hear a lot about them, but I've read a lot about them.
Oh, they were a great empire. They reached as far down into what is now Lebanon.
Mm.
That was their empire. It was quite a... Them and the Egyptians were the main rivals for dominating the Eastern Mediterranean. But they died out. They were assimilated mostly by our people, but mm-hmm. most of them became Greek eventually, sure. Greek-speaking, particularly in the Alexander's... One of the consequences of Alexander's conquests was the assimilation of a lot of the people of Asia Minor, local people who were originally not Greek, they became Greek.
Well, so 2000 BC, the Greeks started to infiltrate Asia Minor. And by the time Alexander the Great, which is what, 300 BC, around there, 200, 300?
He dies 323, so let's call it 330s.
So by the time 330s come around, that whole area is virtually
Hellenized. Yeah.
Hellenized.
Yep. So in Bondos on the Black Sea coast, the first colony is Sinope. That's the first colony. That's around 750 BC. And then from there, so how did the British colonize Australia? Who did they send out here?
Captain Cook first.
Yeah, he just visited.
Convicts.
And then convicts. Arthur Phillip.
Oh, and then once they started not using convicts, they sent out their young and their healthy. And especially who? Veterans. Army veterans. Here's a block of land in the middle of nowhere. Go have a life. Greeks did the same thing.
Okay, so life experience.
It was the 20-somethings and the teens, late teens and 20-somethings that would go out when there was too bit of overpopulation in Sinope, rather than expand the city's walls. Oi, you, go find a new place to live. And they would go a couple of bays along the coast and start a new colony. And all the way around the Black Sea. So you think about all the Black Sea cities, major ones like Batum in Georgia. Mm-hmm. Originally, Vathis Limin, the deep port.
Wow.
Over time became Batum. Poti, again in Georgia. With the war in Ukraine now. Kerch, its original name is Chersonesus. Peninsula. Odysseus. These are all ancient Greek colonies, all these cities around, they're all ancient Greek colonies, and then there's a whole list of them.
Okay.
Amazing.
So Greeks have been there for thousands of years now, so it's quite well documented, you're saying.
Yeah.
Given that, okay, we've established now that there's a Greek presence in all of these parts, you know, which is a very wide geographic area.
Oh, huge.
What are the origins of the Ottomans then? Where did they come from and what period are we talking about them coming in? My understanding is the Ottoman Turks basically are a far more recent...
What we call, and what they call themselves, Turks, have less than 1,000 years in the area. So about less than a quarter of the time that we have a documented presence in that land. I don't know if you know a province or a part of China called Xinjiang. It's the far western part of China, right next to Afghanistan, right? Next to the stands. Where all the
Turkmenistan?
Borders Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm. We play football with them. Okay. Most people only know them because we play football with them.
Yeah. Where's Borat from?
Kazakhstan. It's one of them as well.
Come on.
It's one of them as well.
Yeah.
So that far western part of China, that's the original Turkish homeland.
Right.
So part of mainland China now.
Now.
Okay.
They were squeezed out by their cousins, the Mongols and the Chinese, squeezed out westward. The Persians didn't want them. They used some of them as soldiers, as mercenary soldiers, but most of them kept pushing them on. And eventually, 1061, they attacked the Armenian kingdom in the Caucasus. They take and sack the Armenian capital of Ani, which is now on the border of the Republic of Armenia and the Republic of Turkey. Keep going, and 1071, we have the devastating Battle of Malazgirt or Manzikert, the first time that we have the establishment of a Turkic state in Asia Minor, in Anatolia, around a city called Iconio. Today you'll find it on maps called Konya, famous for the world as being the home of the whirling dervishes. They're a Sufi sect. They're not Sunni. And that's 1071 is the first time you have a Turkic state. They didn't call themselves Ottoman yet. That comes a few generations later.
So that's at least a so Greeks have been in this land for at least 1,000 years.
3,000 years longer.
Oh, so 3,000 years Greeks have been there.
No, before the first Turks set foot in Asia Minor, Greeks already had 3,000 years of history.
So they've had, you know, ancestors after ancestors, history, and so that blows me away. 3,000 years before the Turks actually got there. Wow. And then what happened after 1071?
Slowly, the Seljuk at first, and then Ottoman, named after their great leader Usman, in Arabic, or Osman in Turkish, became Ottoman in English.
All right.
That's how we get Uthman from Arab. In some dialects of Arabic, it's Uthman. So it became Ottoman in English. Slowly expanding their empire, making their own empire, get smashed by the Mongols, by Timurlane and Bayezid in the 1400s. Bit of a respite there, but Konstantinopoli falls, expand all the way across into right to the gates of Vienna eventually, where the Viennese, three sieges of Vienna by the Ottomans, all three fail. And what do the Viennese invent to celebrate their great victory? That they kept the Ottoman, that they kept the Muslims, the Turks, out of Vienna. They invented a pastry.
Really?
Mm. Everybody loves it for breakfast. Croissant.
Oh, really?
That's why it's a crescent.
Oh.
Croissant is French for crescent.
Shit.
And people from Vienna.
It's actually an Austrian pastry. The Austrians invented it. The French love claiming it, but the Austrians invented it.
Did you expect that?
No, not at all.
You want to?
You just hit me for 12.
Hang on a second.
Six.
Sorry, can I just go back a bit?
You want to do talk?
Yeah,
get people in here to talk about the history of Greek cuisine.
We've done that.
No.
And it was equally as controversial, let's say.
Okay, just with the croissant. So you're saying the people from Vienna invented that pastry because they had their victories over the Ottomans. And they named it the crescent what? Because that was...
That's the flag even today. It's the symbol of the flag of Turkey.
Okay, so but that's the crescent moon. Representing them, isn't it?
Yeah, but we eat the crescent, so therefore we win.
Okay, got it.
It's an up yours.
Is that what it is?
It's an up yours.
I really did not expect that.
There's a lot you wouldn't have expected.
No.
Well, the episode's obviously going well because we're going in for another tipudo, so
I think we're back. Mate, this is fascinating stuff.
Did not expect that.
No. All right, so...
Because they needed something nice to go with the thing that they got off the Turks and off the Muslims.
Mm.
We call it coffee.
Okay.
They invented coffee.
The home of coffee is Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how the hell... This is another one of my tangents.
Yeah.
How the hell someone figured out that the beans that had been eaten by cats and then shat out taste good ground up and put in hot water? I don't understand.
I've always wondered these types of things. You know,
I thought it was monkeys. Was it monkeys or cats?
It's cats. Even today, one of the world's most expensive coffees, Ethiopia.
Yeah.
The same method.
Yeah.
The cats eat the beans. They digest the beans, shit them out as beans, then get ground up and turned into coffee. It's the world's second most expensive coffee after Blue Mountain in Jamaica.
Okay. Yummy.
I had the same thing in Indonesia. Same thing. And it was like a...
they probably do use monkeys.
It was like a rodent or something. I don't know what it was. It looked like one of their local animals. And they literally eat it. They shit it out. And someone's job was to go around and look for the poo of this animal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I actually tried it. And it wasn't bad. It was all right.
Yeah.
It was okay.
You don't eat the poo. No, the husk. That does get ground up.
I don't like the way they do it. They do it like in a percolated style coffee.
Yeah, so right. Percolated is not good. But one of the things that the Arab and the Turkish troops of the Ottoman Empire that came to Europe, one of the things they left behind was coffee. So the cafenio that we know, the coffee houses, the first ones were in Vienna in the 1600s.
Okay, I didn't know that either.
And then...
So first coffee houses were in Vienna.
Mm.
So what was it? Sorry, I missed a bit. What was the bit with the Ottomans and coffee?
They're the ones who brought it to Europe.
So they brought it from... How did they get it from Ethiopia?
The Arabs have long contact... Arabia and Ethiopia are just separated by the Dead Sea. They've had trade for
centuries. So the Ottomans got to Ethiopia?
The Arabs got it from the Ethiopians.
Mm-hmm. Traded with...
The Turks got it from the Arabs.
Yep.
And the Europeans got it from the Turks.
Okay. All right, well, he said, I love my coffee. So
do I.
Here you go. Thanks, Turks.
There you go.
Toast to that.
You still got
it. I really did not expect us to be jumping around the geography like this. To talk about a genocide, you know, but it...
Yeah, let's get back to it.
But it does highlight just how important it is to understand all of these things, because it really is important context in the scheme of how we get to this period and what the nuance is.
And this is why I keep talking about the Armenians, the Greeks and the Assyrians as the indigenous peoples of the area. See, unlike, you know, Greeks migrated to that area, you know, 4,000 years ago, the Armenians and the Assyrians were always there. As far as we know from documented histories, they were always there.
Yeah.
That is historic Armenia. That is Bet Nahren, or the land between the rivers, southeast, what we now call southeast Anatolia.
Mm.
So the northern bit of Iraq, the northeastern bit of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Just follow the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers.
So they're the
They're the native people. They've been there since the beginning of recorded history.
Wow. So they're the indigenous type. Mm. But you wouldn't call the Greeks indigenous.
I do.
You do. So
after 4,000 years, come on. How long do you have to be defined as indigenous? How long do you have to be there?
And well, that was my next question. How long does it have to be there to be called
indigenous?
How long
is a piece of string?
Yeah.
But for me,
we'll call it 4,000.
Not all the ones that went there. Sorry, not all the Greeks of most of the Greeks of what we call Pontos, Asia Minor, Cappadocia, were locals who became Greek.
Mm-hmm.
They were assimilated as Greeks. So literally, they are the indigenous peoples.
Yeah, definitely.
Bringing it back closer to where our discussion is supposed to be today. You've mentioned earlier that there are and that you've seen and that you have records, basically, where they're
copies. Yeah,
where they were. Talking specifically about the eradication of these people and how they were going to do it. So I've got a quote here. Now, according to a German military attaché, the Ottoman Minister of War at the time,
Ismail Enver,
had declared in October 1915 that he wanted to solve the Greek problem during the war, in the same way he believed he solved the Armenian problem, referring to the Armenian genocide, of course. So by 31 January 1917, the Chancellor of Germany, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, said that the indications that the Turks planned to eliminate the Greek element as enemies of the state, as they did earlier with the Armenians. The strategy implemented by the Turks is of displacing people to the interior without taking measures for their survival by exposing them to death, hunger, and illness. The abandoned homes are then looted and burnt or destroyed. Whatever was done to the Armenians is being repeated with the Greeks. And that's directly from the Chancellor of Germany in 1917. I mean, in light of that and in light of all the stuff that we've, that you spoke about earlier, is there any way that it can be denied any longer?
Yes.
What else needs to happen in order for it to be...
Denial does not involve fact or logic. That's the basis. That's the beginning of and end of my answer.
Good point. Yeah.
It's very, very difficult. Come on, guys. It's very, very difficult for someone to accept that their grandfather was a rapist and a mass murderer. Papu is Papu. It's like, he can't have killed people. He can't have raped Yaya and kidnapped her and slaughtered her family. And that's how she ended up being my Yaya. But this is what's being discovered now through the DNA testing, which a lot of them, it's actually, they've tried to ban it, but they gave up on it. But
actually, yeah, I did hear about that.
Yeah, they tried to the government tried to ban it because too many people were discovering that they're actually not Turks. Their DNA says that they're Greek, they're Armenian, they're Anatolian. As I said, it's really difficult for them to process that. But until the Turkish state, the population goes through that, like Germany did, the denial is not going to stop. Mm. And the only way Germany did it is because it was forced to. By the Allies literally grabbing them by the neck and shoving them in the faces of the victims at Auschwitz and all the other camps. It's like, here, this is what you guys have done. You cannot deny it. Here you go. And even now, you still have groups in Germany that deny the Holocaust.
Yeah. Which we had a discussion about with Dr. Leon Saltiel. Yeah, recently.
So denial is about emotion and about passion. It's not about facts.
But the key thing with Turkey in particular is that, as you were saying earlier, it's a crime.
It is a crime.
You can't win in that scenario, really. No.
It is a crime. Okay. And here's where they try and... Because I read a lot of their denial material, because unless you understand how your enemy... This is going back to the Sun Tzu Art of War. If you read any book in your lifetimes, you must read that essay. It's only about 30 pages long, so it's not... hard. Unless you understand the way your enemy thinks, you cannot defeat them. I study the denial arguments and love tearing them apart. Now, you mentioned the German Chancellor's quotes. What was Germany in World War One? During the genocide period, what was Germany? An ally of the Ottoman Empire.
Correct.
So your ally is writing that you're criminals. It's not an enemy. It's not enemy propaganda. Your allies are writing this stuff. And this stuff was not public for decades afterwards.
Yeah. But I read there was a reason for that. Greece were neutral at that time, and they didn't want Greece to jump into the war of the Allies. Is there any truth in that?
Complete.
Okay.
Going back to Vrass's quote about Malakias, war breaks out August of 1914. Genocide has started from about January, February of 1914 with the Gallipoli area. Greece was neutral for a really simple reason. We had the Kritiko Prime Minister... Eleftherios Venizelos, who wanted us to join France and Britain. But you had King Konstantinos and his German wife, Sophia, who happened to be Kaiser Wilhelm II's sister, who wanted to join Germany and Austria.
So Kaiser Wilhelm II?
His sister was the Queen of Greece.
I did not know that.
So you had the government, the monarchy going one way and the government wanted to go the other way.
Wow, okay.
And it almost came to a civil war in 1916, or Ethnikos Dichasmos, as it's known, the mm-hmm. national division. Constantine and Sofia go into exile, and Venizelos brings us into the war on the side of the allies in 1917.
Mm. Then we had the Salonika Front and so forth. Okay.
Right. So and that power struggle went back to the Balkans Wars. Yep. We almost lost to Saloniki.
Mm.
So the Greek army was moving up. Prince Andrew, the brother of Constantine, was in charge of the army, heading up through Kozani, Veria, that direction. He wanted to push on to Florina, Skopje, and unite then with the Austro-Hungarians who had taken Serbia. Venizelos sends him a telegram. This telegram exists. You'll find it on the web. If you do not turn right and take the Saloniki before the Bulgarians, I will personally execute you.
Wow.
The Greek army liberated Thessaloniki 4 hours before the Bulgarians got there.
So we could have lost it.
We could have lost the Saloniki.
Forever.
Wow.
Not forever, because we would have gotten... But
anyway,
four hours.
The Greek troops arrived at the Lefko Pirgu and accepted the surrender of the Ottoman governor 4 hours before the Bulgarians arrived.
Wow.
Hey, we were almost speaking French.
Yeah.
Another one of my tangents. Yeah. If the French had colonized the East Coast, or the Dutch had colonized the West Coast, we'd probably be speaking French and Dutch, not English, in Australia. But that's a different story.
Yeah.
But... Okay. All politics, we talk about, you know, big wars and kings and queens and whatever.
Yeah.
It comes down to people, personal relationships.
Yeah.
Venizelos wanted the liberation of Smyrna and Asia Minor. He wanted that. He wanted to turn the Aegean into a Greek lake.
Mm.
And he almost succeeded. The king wanted to unite with his relos.
Yeah.
His in-laws. He thought they were going to win. He was an idiot. And he lost and he died in exile, Dax. Mm. But in the meantime, we lost Asia Minor and Vordiopiro and Cyprus.
Wow. Okay, we always get off track here, but we've got to try and get back off track.
But that's the point. Yeah. This is kind of on the track. This is important context.
It is. Oh, yep. I love all
it's
this.
It's all relevant.
We could so easily go off another tangent, but I just want to get back to the beginning of the genocide, which was 1913, I thought it was.
The winter of 1314.
Okay, so... Tell us how...
The northern winter, yeah. Okay. December onwards.
What were the first rumblings of the genocide now?
We have the two Balkans wars.
Mm-hmm.
Greece has doubled its size.
Mm-hmm.
Crete has joined Greece. The Ionian Islands have joined Greece. Southern Epiros, Macedonia have joined Greece. So the borders of Greece are now up past Serres.
Mm-hmm.
Thrace is still in the Bulgarian hands. Most of the Aegean Islands are now part of Greece, including Imbros and Tenedos, which we were forced to give back 10 years later, except for the Dodecanesa, Kazi, Rhodos, and the other ones, which are still under the Italians at that time. So they're on a high.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans come in. The Turks have secretly sided in 1913. Once they lose the both Balkans wars, they secretly sign a military alliance with Germany. It's before World War I, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And a guy called Limon von Sanders, a field marshal, so the highest rank of the German army, becomes the lead advisor to the Ottoman army. First thing he says is, look at this map. Where is your weak point? The Hellespont, Troy, Gallipoli.
Mm-hmm.
You need to clear that out of all non-Muslims. You cannot have the choke point access to your capital with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of non-Muslims. Enemy Greeks, basically.
So this was the Germans' idea.
Von Sanders is the one who started it, yeah.
Okay.
He didn't want to kill everybody. He wanted to push them out.
Didn't he say the political party in Thessaloniki wrote that in 1909?
But it was his idea to start in Thrace.
Okay.
To start on the frontier regions.
Oh, so the Turks had that anyway in there before Germans spoke to them.
Yeah.
But the Germans said to start here instead of other places. Okay.
Start here.
Okay.
And this is why in Melbourne we have a Krithia Association.
Mm-hmm.
Krithia is, on Australian War Memorials, we'll see it as Achibaba. It's a town on Gallipoli, the only town in the southern part of the peninsula. It's built on a ridge which looks over the entire Aegean. So if you control that ridge, mm-hmm. you control access to Kosinopoli. The New Zealanders almost grabbed it, almost achieved, and that would have changed the whole campaign, but anyway.
So that was the beginning of the genocide.
And that was the beginning of the genocide.
So this town.
The whole peninsula, the Gallipoli Peninsula, and the other side, Asia Minor. So Moskornisia, Phokia, around the Troy district, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And one of those refugees, everybody, especially in the United States, will recognize the name. One of the survivors of the massacres in that area was a young man called Yorgos Seferis, the poet, the Nobel laureate poet.
Oh, okay.
Originally Seferiadis is his real name. He cut it to Seferis. He was originally from the northern...
The Hellespont.
Near the Hellespont. Yeah. Ramos Juanicia, Kidonias.
Mm-hmm.
Aivalia, as we know it today. You'll hear it in songs.
Yeah.
But especially what Dalara's songs talks about, Aivalia. Its Greek name is Kidonias because it had a lot of Kidonia. Yeah. So because of pressure from the Germans, once they cleared, let's call it, cleared that area...
Yeah.
Because of pressure, they didn't want to put too much pressure on the Greeks, on the Greek government to join the Allies.
Yeah.
The Turks' attention switched by 1915 to the Armenians.
Okay, so they touched on the Hellespont. So what does that mean? Does it mean they go into the village? Is it
literally? You have a few hours to pack up and get out, and to help you along, we'll kill a few just for the hell of it
to hurry you up.
See, by the time the war breaks out, there's already a 250,000 Greek refugees in Greece from the east.
So the Turks knew where all the Christians were, like particular houses and shops and so forth.
You know the neighbours. It's not like it's not a big metropolis like Sydney is. You've got to think about more like, I don't know if you guys have ever lived in outside Sydney.
Mm. Everyone knows everyone. Yeah,
you got to think more like a Bower or like a Picton, like a Wollongong.
Yeah,
a regional town. These are regional towns.
Where everyone knows
Gallipoli
everyone.
Town was 10,000-15,000 people.
Yeah,
Goulburn is bigger than that.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, so they went in. They segregated all the Greeks. I said, get out or we'll kill you. They probably killed a few anyway, to let them know they were serious. And that was the...
That was the first wave.
That was the first wave. So once they cleared...
This is all before World War I has started.
Yeah, okay, 1913.
Mm. All right, peace treaty has been signed with the Balkans Wars.
Mm.
Very bad peace treaty for the Ottoman Empire. Very good for us.
Yeah.
But there's no war.
Okay, so there's no reaction by anyone at this time when they heard about it.
Oh, lots of media outrage and blah, blah, blah. But everybody knew World War I was coming.
Okay, so they didn't care so much. Well, they had other focus.
It was a sideline. They had other focus.
Yeah, okay.
So it obviously then continued throughout World War I and then escalated afterwards? Is that the
throughout trajectory? World War I, as you read from the quotes, throughout World War I, the focus, 1516, the focus was in the east with the Armenian population. Again, for strategic reasons. Who was on the other side of the Armenians?
Russians.
The Russian Empire.
Yeah.
How did we have so many Greeks from Bondos who survived? Because the eastern half of Bondos was under Russian rule in World War One.
Mm-hmm.
They were protected. We have very few from Western Bondos. Think about Yanina.
Yeah.
Bafra and Nalkesaria.
Mm-hmm.
Those two villages behind, next to Bizani.
Yeah.
On the way out, on the left, as you head out on the old highway. That's from Western Bondos.
All right.
Mm. Bafra and Nalkesaria are towns in Western Pontus. There's not many Bafra and Nalkesaria around Greece. There's hardly any.
Wow. So you're saying the migrants went all the way to Epiros?
Yeah, that's because there were so few of them, they just dumped them there.
And they named the town after their old town.
Well, now it's basically one town, but it used to be two separate villages. They wiped out the Armenians, and we have, and this is a lot of the focus of my research, is what did the Australians document about this.
Mm.
Not just the media, which were basically copies of the British media and the American media.
Yeah.
But the Anzacs who were captured on Gallipoli and around the different battlefronts, what did they see? What did they record?
And you've got all that documented.
It's all in Canberra.
Tell us some of the stories.
There were 9 Australians in a town called Kut El Amara. It's in the southern part of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, Mesopotamia, okay. Big long siege, they get captured.
Sorry, were Australian prisoners, you're saying? Or?
These are Australian servicemen, the beginning of the RAAF, the Royal Australian Air Force.
Yep.
Back then it was called the Half Flight, the Australian Half Flight, just the beginning of the Australian Air Force.
Yep.
They were captured when this town fell in southern Iraq. They were part of the British Army.
Sorry, yep, so they were prisoners.
They were part of the British Army, they were captured, they were prisoners of war.
Yep.
They were marched up through what we now call Iraq, across the top of Syria and over the mountains into Anatolia and then put on trains and sent to various camps, prisoner of war camps around Anatolia. The prisoner of war camps were typically monasteries or churches of Greeks and Armenians. I can tell you the names of the churches and the names of the towns, and everything's documented.
Yeah.
On the march over, one of them who survived wrote about he knew exactly where they were heading. All they had to do was follow the bodies.
Oh, wow.
Because in the other direction were the Armenian and the Greek deportation columns, or Lefkos Thanatos, the White Death. They were just marched until they died.
Wow.
All they had to do was, he knew the route they were going to take, because on the other side of the road, in the other direction, every few meters there was a body.
Mm.
Or a skeleton. The further in they got, the more like skeletons rather than bodies.
So that's well known as the
This is
the
1916, 1917.
Wow. Okay, so this is the death march.
Yeah, the death marches.
So what is a death march? Is that when you just
exactly
keep on...
like you see in the World War II Holocaust movies.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly the same thing. You just walk until you drop dead.
Really?
You're not given water. You're not given food. You just keep walking.
Wow.
If you drop, you get shot or stabbed. If you want to, this has been a pretty lighthearted, for a genocide discussion, it's been a pretty lighthearted episode so far.
Yeah.
But if you want to, a really dark episode, let's just compare how the Nazis, let's just look at how the Nazis copied what the Turks did a generation before.
Well, actually, that's what I was going to turn. Yeah, that's. I think we're both thinking along the same lines, because it's almost like
it's a very dark episode.
They've used this as as the blueprint to some degree.
Run, yeah.
One sentence. One question for you both. Where were the officers of the German army who later became senior officers of the Nazis in World War One? Where were they?
Probably in France.
Somewhere in the Ottoman.
They were the liaison officers with the Ottoman army.
Right.
They saw the genocide. They saw exactly how it was conducted. They were there. We've got their writings.
So, wow. So they've just copied it and touched it up and... Fine-tuned it.
This is why, instead of just massacring everybody out in the streets like they did in Anatolia, or get everybody together in the church and then burn it with a couple of thousand people inside. No, that's barbaric. We need a better way to do it. We'll do a gas chamber.
Mm.
Not in Germany. God, no, not in Germany. Out there in the east somewhere, in the middle of a godforsaken town.
Poland, yeah. Yeah, wow. Okay, so you're saying this is heavy shit. So.
Yes. Genocide studies gives you a very warped sense of humour. Mm.
Did anyone survive these death marches? And
a few did.
Okay. So where were they?
Typically ones who were able to escape.
Okay.
Like in the middle of the night, act dead.
Yep.
Run away, roll into a water and into a river and float down a bit out of sight. There's a whole number of stories.
Okay. So is that how the story got out of the death march? Because some of the survivors...
No, even the Germans knew about it.
Okay.
The German press was the German press was publishing stuff about it. Really? The Australian press was full of these stories.
Really?
It wasn't hidden. And this is one of the things the Nazis knew they had to change.
Mm.
They had to hide the killing.
Okay.
So deportation became resettlement.
Mm.
Think about that quote you read and the language of it.
Yeah.
Language is very important in genocide studies, because especially anywhere in the East, there's always a double meaning to the words. Resettlement.
Mm-hmm.
Deportation.
Mm.
It's basically a death sentence.
Yeah.
Yes, we're going to move you. Deportation and resettlement are. Mm. We're going to move you somewhere.
Yeah.
But resettlement, doesn't that imply that, you know, we're going to look after you, give you a new place to farm, a new place to live?
Mm.
It's just using more positive language.
It's an easy way to get you out of your home.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
Okay. All right, so that all happened in, 1917, in these death marches, and you said...
through until 1922.
So what else happened? You said they put people in churches, locked the church and then set it on fire. Was that a common thing back then?
There's a famous cave in what is now Syria, where they still find bones in there.
Really?
They put in their hundreds and then poured in petrol and set it alight.
Mm.
This was an Armenian case along Bondos, anywhere near sea or lakes.
Yeah.
Take them out in rowboats and throw them over the side. Thousands, tens of thousands.
Really? Died in the ocean?
Mm.
Just drowned. I think we touched on it earlier. So there are different types of Greeks. The Pontus, where...
These are all just regional identifications.
Okay.
So we had, for those of you interested, Australians interested, you know, state of origin, Bondus is like saying Queensland. It's like saying New South Wales. Okay. It's a regional identification.
Okay.
But because we're talking about people who have been there for thousands of years, they developed their own dialect, their own style of food, their own style of dance, their own style of music, which, well, Queensland, New South Wales are a couple of hundred years old, so they haven't had time to develop these things.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay. And we have the Cappadocian Greeks, which were the centre. They're the three main ones, aren't they?
Four. Thraki, Thracians, Asia Minor, Cappadocians, and Pontians.
Pontians, okay.
The Cappadocians tended to be Turkish-speaking because there's just so few of them.
Yeah.
The most famous Cappadocian, everybody knows him. Hardly anybody knows he was Cappadocian.
Ilya Kazan?
Someone more famous than Ilya Kazan.
Really? Who?
Aristoteles Onassis.
Was he from there?
Onassis was born in Smyrna. Everybody knows him as Smyrna.
Yeah, correct.
But the family was from Sinassos in Cappadocia.
Oh,
his
really?
Grandparents migrated to Smyrna.
Oh, wow.
They're originally from Cappadocia.
Yeah,
and his father had actually paid for the water fountain, the Sintirivani of the village, the steady water supply, to be made into this ornate stone. It's still there. Ornate stone sculpture.
Wow.
Still brings out fresh water.
Sorry, Cappadocia.
In Cappadocia, yeah.
Wow, I've been there.
Sinassos.
I've actually seen it. No, I don't know about that town. I've been in Cappadocia.
It's one of the major, the main settlements of Cappadocia.
Because they've got these underground cities.
Yeah. They predate our time.
Oh, really?
They predate the Greek presence in that area, yeah.
Yeah.
And the Greeks used them, but the original of those cities predate.
Okay.
They were there before the Greeks arrived there. But the churches are obviously ours.
Yeah. Because there were Orthodox symbols in some of these caves.
Yeah.
As well.
A lot of these caves, especially when you get to the 18, 1900s, where people are living in houses, even though the caves were actually much healthier, you didn't need air conditioning. The stone did the air conditioning for you.
So how many people are we talking about in Cappadocia they've got?
Greeks, only a few tens of thousands.
Okay.
Orthodox.
So there's none there now, obviously.
No.
They're all gone.
No, they've all left. Most of them, you'll find them concentrated around Kavala.
Okay.
Their descendants are now mostly around Kavala. And there are some of their villages around Kavala that still speak, they don't speak every day. Some of the old people, maybe in the 90s, would still speak, but their songs are in Ottoman.
Okay.
So the old 1800s Turkish, which is very, a lot of Persian and a lot of Greek and a lot of other languages in there, particularly Persian.
So based on what we were talking about earlier with that blueprint that you spoke about, that are in the records about, this is how you systematically eradicate a people. How close did they come in terms of executing that to the letter? Was there much deviation in the plan, or can it be traced right back to these documents?
Asia Minor today, from about pre-World War I, 20-25% Christian, has maybe a couple of thousand Christians left in the entire region. And this is a region that is, I don't know, the width of New South Wales. So they succeeded in eliminating the physical presence. There is an Armenian village in the earthquake zone around Hatay. There are some Assyrian villages left around Mardin and Diyarbakir. These are in the southeast. There are a few Greeks in Smyrna, but as a viable population, they've basically been wiped out.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes, they succeeded.
What numbers are we talking about? So how many Greeks that live there?
This is why today, to this point, I've avoided using the word numbers.
I guess
we just don't know.
Yeah.
For two reasons. One, the census data is shockingly inaccurate because Christians paid a poll tax. They paid a special tax only as Christians, the jizya. Muslims didn't pay this tax. Only Christians paid this tax.
Okay.
So families with 10, 12, 7, 8 children would declare they had 3 or 4 to avoid the extra tax.
Right.
This is a pre-digital age, so who's going to bother counting? There's enough money there for the taxman to take his cut, to take the government to take his cut, the governor to take his cut. We'll figure it out. Two, and here's the least studied part of the genocide. What happens to the ones who converted to Islam?
Yeah, good point.
There were hundreds of thousands of them. Because today, especially in Pontus, especially in eastern Pontus, there are hundreds of thousands of people who speak Pontian. They don't call it Pontian.
Even to this
day. They call it Romaica or Rumje, the language of the Romans.
All right.
Now, what do we mean by Romans?
Byzantine Empire. Roman
Empire.
Exactly. Yeah.
Byzantine Empire. So the Orthodox, Greek-speaking Orthodox. But they're Muslim. They have Turkish names. But they have our dances, our traditions. Everything is the same.
But they call themselves Muslim.
But they're Muslim. Oh, they call themselves, they are Muslim.
Oh, they are.
Yeah. They are Muslim.
Yeah.
The most famous one today is the mayor of Constantinople, Imamoglu.
Yeah, tell us about him. Who is he?
He's the mayor of Konstantinopoli, but
right now, yeah,
he's the main challenger to Erdogan as the president of the country. Okay. This is something I love about the contemporary.
And who is he? Has he got a Christian connection?
İmamoğlu in Greek is Papadopoulos.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's the son of the imam, the son of the priest.
So he's Greek.
I would not call him Greek.
Okay.
I will say that he is from Trapezunda, and he does. Actually, I haven't heard him speak, but he does dance our style, Pontian, what we call Pontian dancing. There are videos of him. If you type in Ekrem İmamoğlu dancing, just now in the election campaign, he was doing it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And one of the really funny things about their modern politics is that you have Erdogan, who is from Rizunda, which is in Pontus, against İmamoğlu, who is from Trapezunda in Pontus.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of the other top elite, all from Pontus. Wow. They're all from what they call the Karadeniz, the Black Sea district.
Yeah.
That's what their name for. We call Pontus.
Yeah.
They call it the Black Sea region.
Mm.
And they're the leadership of the state at the moment.
Mm.
It's all Greeks. So there you go.
So we've taken over.
It's not a matter of taking over. Erdogan's not Greek. Erdogan, I believe, is his family is originally Lez, who are Georgians who became Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how you had this bunch of horsemen that invaded in 1061, to almost 80 million people now. It's because they assimilated a whole bunch of people over the years, either voluntarily or by force. We forget about the this morning I was at the a public forum about The Voice, and we talk a lot about the stolen generations of the First Nations of Australia. Hardly ever do we talk about the stolen generations of our people, the people of Masuma. Did your parents or your grandparents ever threaten you with the babula?
Yes. Yeah. I think I do that too.
Definitely.
I don't think I have done it.
You have done it?
Yes.
Who's the babula?
The babula was the Ottoman tax collector that would come along and collect a number of children from the village as a tax.
Is that right?
All right.
Yeah. Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's where it started.
Shit. And here I am threatening it.
The tax.
Please tell me you did that too.
God, yeah.
So essentially saying the taxman's going to come and get you.
Yeah.
And take you away. Babulas. Yeah. Don't we say
that's
that?
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
My grandmother said it. Babulas
erichete.
Yeah. That's who the babula was.
Why?
It was the taxman.
Ottoman taxman.
The Ottoman taxman. The smartest ones of the children.
Yep.
The smartest ones of the children that would be collected would end up in the bureaucracy. Wait a minute.
Yamas.
Jeez.
Yeah. And the more attractive ones would end up, either boys or girls, would end up in the harems. The dumb, ugly ones would end up as the army.
Mm-hmm.
What do we call them? What's that special unit of the army called?
The Jarrisons?
The Janissaries, exactly.
Janissaries.
The Janissaries.
Yeah.
Yeni, new, Tseri, troops.
Yeni, new, Tseri. Tseri's troops, is it?
Which in English became Janissaries. Mm. In Greek, it's Yeni Tsari. They were converted to Islam by force, raised as Muslims. These are up to the age of about 11.
Yeah, because I've read a lot of stories about people doing their DNA, speaking of DNA, and a lot of Turks saying, well, hang on, I thought I was Turkish this whole time. And some of them are converting to Christianity now. Yeah.
The bravest ones are.
Mm.
And they can't stay in at home. They have to leave.
Mm.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Is that because of the policy of apostates from the faith? Or
mostly that.
Mm.
But also because there's a whole bunch of secularists, extreme nationalist secularists, that will kill them. You can't be anything but Turkish. Let's just. I mean, you guys are old enough. You remember the old speak English or die attitude back in the 80s and the 70s?
I just missed it, but I...
Well, I'm showing my age now.
That's okay. I hear you, mate. I'm on your side.
The Cronulla... This is very Australian.
Cronulla riots.
The Cronulla riots attitude.
Yeah.
All right. It's just below the surface.
Yeah, okay. Well, so we talked about numbers before. So
we just don't know. What we can say based on the census figures and natural birth rates and natural death rates, without World War I in the way, we can talk about 800,000 to 1.2 million Greeks disappearing.
From that region?
From the Evros River to the Caucasus.
Okay, 800 to 1.2 million Greeks.
So ballpark a million, let's call it that.
So disappearing means one of three things. They've either dead.
Or converted.
Converted or gone to Greece or left.
The ones who came to Greece are all documented, every single one. We've got their name, we've got where they came from, we've got what property they left behind. The League of Nations did all this documentation.
Okay. So my question is now, sorry.
And those reports still exist. They're all in Geneva.
Okay. But I understand there's a lot of Orthodox in, say, Jordan, in Lebanon, all these other countries, Russia in particular. Yep. So how many of them would have not gone to Greece, gone to these other
particularly,
countries in the area?
Particularly from Bondos, eastern Bondos, just because it was closer, a lot of them ended up in the Russian Caucasus, in Georgia, in places further north. Where the Winter Olympics was a few years ago, Sochi, that district up there, until the war last year.
Actually, Larry Papadopoulos.
Yeah.
One of our guests, his grandparents are from Russia. They migrated back to Greece, but he went on the episode and told us the story. But okay, so
there's a number of the Pondoxenitheos and Panagiotis Melas Society people here in Sydney, a number of them, especially Pondoxenitheos side, whose families moved from eastern Pondos to places like Yelenjik around the Sea of Azov, where the fighting is now. And points further south on that coast. Yeah. Stalin then deported them, their whole families, to middle of Asia, so places like Kazakhstan. And then when Stalin died, they moved back there, or they moved to Greece and then came here a few years later to Australia.
So what about the Lebanese Orthodox, and in particular Jordan? Because I met a few in Jordan, in the country Jordan, Orthodox. Would they be people leaving Asia Minor at that time?
Some yes, but not mostly no. Mostly okay. They'd be there. You've got to remember, before Islam only exists from the 630s AD, or CE to be more correct, after Jesus. It's only about 1,400 years. Before that, for about 300 years or so, the dominant element were Orthodox Christians. So the back end of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, okay.
Before the Arabs became Muslim and conquered the whole area.
Yeah.
The area was Greek-speaking. This is why almost all the holy sites around Jerusalem and Israel are under the control of the Patriarchate of Jerusalem.
Yeah, okay. So, all right, so we understand that was the numbers. So
Ballpark. Very ballpark. Yeah, 1.5 million Armenians, about a million Greeks, roughly 750,000 Assyrians. But these are very ballpark figures. I hate using rough
estimates. Okay. So the Greeks would have caught on eventually. They're being evicted.
Oh, very quickly.
Did they put up a...
Was there an armed resistance?
Back?
Big time.
Really? Okay.
Particularly in Pondos, simply... Back to the original lesson.
Yeah,
you cannot study history without geography.
Mm.
Bondos is like the east coast of Australia. You've got this thin strip down the coast, big mountain ranges, way bigger than Katoomba or the Blue Mountains. We're talking about Snowy Mountains levels, 2,000 metres, Gevalle, and then the interior plateau. So getting up into those mountains with thick forests, again, because of the geography, the moisture from the Black Sea would fall on Bondos as rain. And then once it cleared the mountains, there would be not much rain. Exactly like the east coast of Australia.
Ah, so it's all desert after that.
It became desert about 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
Before that, it was the breadbasket of the empire. It's one of the reasons the Byzantine Empire collapsed. So Bondos is very green. Lots of forests on the northern side of the mountains. Lots of forests.
Yeah.
Easy to hide a guerrilla force in. And a number of them, especially from eastern Pontus, survived because they were hiding in the mountains with guerrilla fighters. They survived because they fought.
So they put up a bit of a fight, even though the Ottomans were still wiping out, going through different villages and burning them and so forth. Some converted, I guess, you know.
They did.
My understanding, so 1919, the Greco...
Yep. May of 1919 is important for two reasons. One, a guy called Mustafa Kemal... left Constantinople because there was an arrest warrant for him from the British, landed at a place called Samsunda, a city called Samsunda. Amisos is its ancient name, one of the ports, and started what became the Turkish nationalist movement, which eventually won. His nickname was the Grey Wolf.
So they've got a political party called the Grey Wolf, don't they?
That's why they're called the Grey Wolves.
Okay.
That's one reason. But there's a whole myth about the Grey Wolf, supposedly a Grey Wolf, led the original Turks out of Asia to the promised land of Anatolia, one of the national myths. Right, yeah. a bit like Jason and the Argonaut story.
Mm. What is it with wolves and the foundation of cities? Isn't Rome built on the same sort of thing? Was it a wolf?
Oh yes, the she-wolf who raised the twins. But this is talking about doublespeak.
Mm.
The Latin name for a madam, as in a brothel keeper, was lupanar, female wolf, she-wolf. So you go, think about it. Were they talking about a couple of offspring from the brothel, or were they talking about literally a she-wolf?
Great question. There you go.
But this is the double speak of...
I feel like everything's linking in now.
It is.
Everything's making sense with this.
It might be the tip.
But this is history is a bunch of stories chucked together. Our jobs as historians, as scholars, is to show people how they link.
The links, yeah, definitely.
Nothing is... by itself. We're sitting here because our parents migrated here. Why did our parents migrate here? Because Greece was a hellhole. Why was it a hellhole? Because did your parents leave in the 60s or 70s or a bit later?
Grandparents in the 50s.
In your case, your grandparents in the 50s. Mine in the 60s.
60s, yeah. Early 60s. 60s, yeah.
10 years of war, the place was flattened.
Mm.
Think about Greece. Between 1940 and 1949, it was at war.
Mm.
Especially in our parts.
Yeah,
in the north. Look at the videos from Ukraine. That was Greece.
Yeah, there's nothing there. No,
there was nothing there.
Yeah.
So they left. Why was nothing there? Because everything is interlinked.
And we can go back. You know, we just discussed. You know, 200 years.
Yeah. So why are we drinking tsipuro? Why did they invent tsipuro?
Not for the throat, I'm assuming.
Why not?
Tell us.
Well, think about it. Did they have refrigeration?
No. So tsipro...
So they needed a drink that could survive just sitting on the shelf.
Yeah, but it's actually made from... Once you've made your wine...
It's the leftovers.
The leftovers. So they'll...
Think about the Easter lamb.
Yep.
What did they leave aside from the Easter lamb? Don't worry about us today. Back in the day, they left hardly anything.
Yeah,
even the bones were used as fertilizer. The guts were used for magiritsa or for kokoretsi.
Kokoretsi. I love it.
Love the stuff. Drowned it in lemon juice.
The best.
Tokyo Falaki, I can't eat it, but you go down to Marrickville, to Marrickville Sistaria, and there's Kefalakia in the window. Mate, they used the entire
slip
animal.
Slip out the eyeballs.
They used the entire animal.
Yeah, that's right.
Why is our region famous for its bitters?
Cold, warm, I don't know, wood fires.
Exactly.
Mountains, yep.
And doesn't need refrigeration. They go for a few days without going off.
Yeah.
Whereas the islanders, there's more seafood in their diet.
Mm.
Ours is more vegetarian until really 1980s onwards.
Yeah. Yep.
Meat was for feast days.
Yeah, that's legumes and all that. Yeah.
Okay. These are just practical...
Yeah. Everything makes sense. There's a story behind everything, which is what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
So
the Pondians have surva. We just call it trahanas. It's basically the same, but the Pondians will typically serve it with olive oil on top. But it's basically the same dish.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll say tikanis. The Pondians will say deftas.
Which means the same thing.
It means the same thing. Yeah. But their dialect is so archaic. Because of the isolation, because they were cut off from the main education centres, Konstantinopoli, Thessaloniki, Yanina.
Would you say their dialect is closer to classical Greece, ancient Greece?
No. It's closer to one of the pre... See, when we call it classical Greek, we're talking about the dialect of Athens. Their dialect is older than that.
Oh, really?
It predates that. The closest relation to Pondian is Kypriaka.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
Again,
that makes
isolated
sense.
From the main centres, they developed their own dialect. Wow. So when you listen to Pondian, it sounds Caucasian. It sounds kind of like Eastern European, whereas Kypriaka, again, because of the Venetian island trading influence, has a more sing-song lilt to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a result of this event, obviously we know and we've seen the stories and the repercussions in history of what actually happened to Greece in areas like Bidaia, and, you know, the influx of refugees. What was the impact of having so many refugees coming into the country following these events over the course of a decade?
The first refugees arrive at about 1914. Some go back, especially from Thrakia. When Thrakia was liberated, some of them went back. 22 onwards when they came here and they stayed, there's a number of influences. One, the population of the country increases by 25% in one hit.
Yep.
Now, let's put that in US terms for the American audiences. You think you've got a problem with immigration? Try having 80 million of your own people rock up on the doorstep. And they're your people. They're your relatives. You can't turn them away.
Mm.
80 million in US terms. 6 million in Australian terms.
Yeah, it's huge.
So think about how long it takes.
Yeah, house them, feed them.
Thank you.
Everything, yeah.
To build housing, hospitals, schools, roads, la, la, la, la, la, on and on and on.
Mm.
Took decades.
And the effects were felt, maybe still being felt to some degree. You know,
oh, completely. I mean, think about the influence on music.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Tarebetica.
Tarebetica. Tarebetica were born in Smidny, adapted then in particularly Pirea, but also particularly around Pirea. This is why the ultra-conservative governments of the 60s tried to ban Rebetica, because they grew out of the hash stands,
yep.
The speed of its day. Think about our diet. Half the sweets we eat, we call Greek sweets, are from the East.
Mm.
Ravani.
Mm-hmm. Baklava.
Baklavas. These are all Eastern Greek. Until the 20s, they were barely known in Greece.
We have Bugatza.
No, Bugatza's a classic one of ours.
Okay, good. I should, same.
Bugatza's descendant is Galactoburico.
Okay, yeah.
True.
It's a simplified form of Bugatza. It's a lesser version of Bugatza.
Yeah. Okay.
So, come on, we have to show our Epirotic superiority. Come on.
That's right. We are going to get you on an Epirotic episode, but that's
And you look at just last October.
Yeah.
All right. One of the most amazing events in Greek in the last 100 years in Greek history, the opening of the Agia Sophia Stadium.
Mm. Yeah,
amazing stadium.
We need to go there.
We are. We're going to finish off with that, but I wanted to just to touch on.
I'm going to finish off with that. Okay, I'll stop there. No. I went there in February and I got so excited.
No, you did. We are. I want to hear more about that story because you did touch on it when we caught up. So. We talked about the massive immigration as well, but really the pinnacle was the fires in Smidny, wasn't it? Was that
the most violent, single most violent episode of the whole genocide was Smidny, September 1922. Literally the whole city was torched.
Yeah. So that was after so we sort of touched
this
on
right
the war.
This is right at the end. So this World War One finished in 4 years earlier.
Yeah. So 1922.
September 1922, Kemal's forces move into the city. It was not defended. All the Greek troops, all the Greek forces had been evacuated. An interesting sideline, the last unit of the Greek army to leave Smidny was the Armenian Legion.
Mm.
The Armenians did not live in Greece from 22 onwards. There was a pre-existing community. And they volunteered to because one quarter of Smidny was Armenian. There's an Armenian quarter.
Mm.
There was the Greek quarter, the Frankish quarter.
Yeah.
Just like Jerusalem, there was four big neighborhoods, four parts of the city.
And Lenin had one quarter.
The three down the coast, or on the seaboard, were the Frankish one, the Greek one, and the Armenian one. And inland, away from the port, and away from, and here's the giveaway about talking about, going back to the beginning, we're talking about threats and why they were considered threats. Who controlled the economy?
The Greeks, the
ports. Greeks, the Armenians, and the Jews.
Mm.
They controlled the imperial economy. And this, again, is historical because the Turks consider themselves warriors. Commerce was beneath them.
Okay.
I don't know if either of you Trekkies.
Star Trek?
I don't mind a bit of Star Trek.
More Star Wars.
Yeah, more Star Wars.
Okay, don't worry about it then. But in Star Trek terms, the Turks saw themselves as Klingons. They were warriors.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Commerce is beneath us.
Mm.
You Ferengi, you just deal with money. But over time, this gave them political power because everything comes from money. So the commercial areas, the nice areas, and when you think about the climate, again, the climate. Here in Sydney, what are the most expensive suburbs? The ones next to the water because they get the cooler breezes in summer not as cold in winter. The coldest parts of Sydney are only Camden where it goes sub-zero now in winter.
Foot of the mountains. Yeah.
The same with Smidny. Mm. Inland was where the Muslims lived.
Mm-hmm.
So they waited a few days until the winds were blowing from the east towards the west, set the fires, burnt the entire Christian quarter. So literally two-thirds of the city was rubble.
I understand. It was 9 days. The city burnt for 9 days.
The city burnt because most of the construction was timber.
Mm. And so the people at that time, they were virtually, pushed into the ocean?
Literally, not virtually, literally. I mean, you've got the classic paintings and things.
Mm.
But there is photographs in the National Geographic. You can search it online.
Yeah.
National Geographic, November 1925, published an entire 52-page dedication, History's Greatest Trek.
Mm.
And there's a number of photos of Smidney before and after.
Yeah.
There is footage by the Near East Relief Association, film of the fires.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, actually, I've seen footage
taken from the sea.
Yeah.
Because it's the only safe place to film it.
Mm. But my understanding was there were boats that were trying to liberate as many people.
Mostly organised by an American called Asa Jennings, yes.
Yeah.
The most amazing story for me is the Toke Maru.
Mm-hmm.
What does that sound like? What language does it sound like?
Polynesian or something to
close.
Me.
Close. Japanese.
Oh, right.
It was a Japanese ship.
Okay.
Right.
In the harbour when the fire started. The Chinese captain threw all the cargo overboard.
Really?
Wow.
Packed it with refugees, took them to Samoa. No, not Samoa, Kio.
Yep.
The nearest island. Went back, took them to Athens, went back four times.
Really?
Wow.
Rescued something like 3,000 people.
Wow.
From Smidney in September of 1922.
Chinese captain. Wow.
Chinese captain of a Japanese-owned boat.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
If you Google Toke Maru, you'll see a short video done by a friend of mine in Thessaloniki, Zaho Samolada.
I'll have to look at that.
Wow. It's an animated video.
I did read stories. There were... I don't know.
That's just one amazing story.
No, but that's what we want to hear. I want to hear these stories, right? This is stuff that gets lost sometimes.
You hear about the French pouring boiling water on people trying to reach up and only accepting French passports.
Were they true?
They're true.
There was true.
But it wasn't at Smidney. That was at Mudanya.
Because I read stories that Greeks
would swim
out and they'd get the band on the boats to play louder, not to hear all the
screaming.
So
they could drown out the screaming. They would only accept their own citizens. That was the orders they had from their governments.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, the story that comes to mind, and it has a somewhat victorious ending to some degree, is the story that Admiral James Stavridis told us, because his family were originally from there.
Mm.
And left, you know, under those circumstances. And then he comes back, you know, 60, 70, you know, odd years later.
As the NATO commander.
In a billion-dollar warship.
Billion-dollar warship.
Amazing, yeah.
You know, like just, the image of him sailing back into this harbour after so many years of being away from his family, you know, not having a presence there.
Yeah.
In command of, you know, ostensibly the strongest fleet possibly in the world.
Mm.
Unbelievable.
So more about the end of the genocide was in 1923, as we commented. So a lot of the strong swimmers would swim out to some of the boats in the harbours, but I believe there were British ships and French ships.
American, Italian, you name it, they were there because they all had consulates there. They all had business people there. That's why you had the Frankish Quarter.
Okay.
Frangi.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back to the
Rebetica. So Franks, they're French?
Franks is just our
who are the
nickname.
Franks?
Any Westerner.
Oh, okay. Franks are any Westerner.
Any Westerner. You know, have your parents or grandparents ever used the phrase franga?
Yeah, yes.
For franga. For currency?
It's
franc. It's the French franc, the Swiss franc. It's the currency.
That's why I thought they were French.
Yeah.
So the quarter in Smidney, the Franks, were anyone?
Any Westerner.
Any Westerner.
Levantine.
Okay.
So Catholic or Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best testimonies we have of the actual days of the fires, what was happening while the fires were burning inside the city, was from the Anglican priest, Anglican minister of Smidney, who was born in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
Shit. Yeah, he's a Kiwi.
And he
wrote his diary. It's online. Okay. His diary, his granddaughter Joanne has published his memoir online.
So he was a priest in Smidney.
He was the priest of the Church of England Church in Smidney. Born in New Zealand. He was evacuated later and died on Malta, relatively young.
Yeah.
But had enough time to write what was actually how they were hunting, the Kemal's men were hunting door to door, particularly for Armenians, also for Greeks, but particularly for Armenians, and how he tried to hide one in the graveyard of the church and didn't. He was caught and taken away and slaughtered in the most horrible ways. And was eventually, Charles Dobson, was eventually evacuated and wrote, and he says it quite clearly. And this is a guy not sitting on a ship offshore in Smidney.
Lived and breathed
when
it.
When the fires were lit, and he goes, they were going door to door in the Greek Quarter setting fires.
Wow.
They had looted it. They had taken whatever they thought was valuable enough to take and then set fire to what was left, because you've got to understand what the nickname of the Kemals of the Turki for Smyrni was Gyauri Smir. Infidel Ismir. The city of infidels, unbelievers. How do you purify something?
Yeah.
You, in the old days, you get a battle wound. How did you seal the wound?
Cauterize it.
Fire.
With fire.
Yeah.
So you burn the city to cleanse it.
And I understand they targeted the priests, the archbishops in the town first.
Yeah. And because they're the leaders.
Yeah.
That's the cutting the head that you spoke about.
Yeah. You decapitate the community. When there's no leadership, who's going to organize any sort of resistance?
Yeah.
It takes time. The Nazis did exactly the same thing 20 years later.
Were the priests organized resistance, or would it have been someone else?
Of course they did.
So they... Okay.
Of course they did. Mm. You look at the Makedoniko Agona 20 years earlier. The Ottomans knew this.
Yeah.
This is why in the Ottoman system, you weren't categorized, you weren't recorded, you weren't documented by your... Nationality didn't exist. Your nationality was your faith. Where did you worship? That was your identity.
Okay.
If you were Orthodox, you were part of the Rum Milliet, the Roman people, what we call Orthodox. If you were Muslim, you were part of the Ulema. You're one of us. Listen to the language. One of us. If you are Jewish, you are a Musavi. You're people of Moses. So you're okay, kind of, but you're not really one of us, etc., etc. So who was responsible for the behavior? This is why when the revolution happened in 1821, who paid the price for the revolution breaking out? The patriarch was hung up outside the western door of the Church of St. George, the patriarchal church, and the door is still closed. It's been closed ever since.
Where is this at?
Kostanopoli, the Fanari.
So it's a door that's never been opened since.
It has not been opened since.
Where is this door?
The western door of the church.
Yeah.
What's on the other side of that door?
The church. It's the western door into the church.
But you can't go in.
They've sealed it since. They've closed it. It's not been opened since his execution, because he was hung, literally put a noose around his neck and has strung him up outside that door.
And they've never opened it.
And they've never opened it since.
Wow, what a story. So I've been there. I wish I'd known that when I was there.
I saw it, actually.
Chrysostomos, the Archbishop of Smyrni, who is now, since then he's been canonized, he's now Saint Chrysostomos, was literally torn limb from limb.
Really?
While he was alive, literally torn apart, pulled his beard out. I'm not going to go into the details, but yeah. And what was left of him was then thrown into the sea along with his vestments, because he was wearing the vestments, and the vestments were rescued later, and they're now in Athens.
Sorry, vestments is his outfit.
His robes, his priestly robes.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I have to ask, how was he torn apart? Give us an insight.
Cut his ears off, cut his nose off, pulled his beard out, and then we're literally cut to pieces.
Right.
What, with a machete?
As in, one at a time, with machetes and knives, literally cut him to pieces. So there was no body to bury.
Okay. And then they threw him in the ocean.
And then they threw the bits in the harbour.
Someone witnessed this too.
Number of witnesses, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, there's those sort of... There's stories of crucifixions. There's stories of breasts being cut off.
And we talk... Women went off. You know, women were treated just like the men. Killed and raped.
It depends how good looking they were.
If they were good looking?
If they were good looking, they'd just be abducted.
Okay, so that's
and married off to the son, because there was no dowry involved. End of story. This is why so many of people today who call themselves Turk but look European do the DNA test. We were talking about it earlier and find out that, crap, I've got Greek in me. How? And then you get the deathbed confessions. There are a number of prominent lawyers now in Kostanopoli who say, and one has written about them, These are completely Turkish-speaking Turks their whole lives, and find out on their grandmother's deathbed that Yahya was actually Armenian. She'd lived most of her life as a Turk and was an Armenian.
Yeah.
Wow. And now coming up and say, well, what the hell does that make me? I'm the product of rape. What does that make me?
Yeah.
So they're talking about traumas and...
It's a lot to unravel. Yeah, imagine growing up and hearing that story.
Yeah.
About your grandparents and so forth.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, very, very, very heavy stuff.
I mean, I guess there needs to be a level of understanding to these people now who are uncovering that sort of thing as well. Who,
very much so.
You know, in a similar way to the guilt that the Germans feel for, you know, which is well documented nowadays.
But it's still a conscious decision. Once you learn, especially now in the digital age, pre-1990s, yes, I could feel sorry for them. They didn't know. But with the digital age, with what we know today, with the access to documents, to survivor testimonies, to stories that we have, if you continue to deny, you're making a conscious decision. And in genocide, studies, we talk about the final phase of a genocide is not the killing. It's the killing of memory. Denial is the final phase of a genocide, which never ends. So that's why I agreed straight away to come and talk with you guys.
Yeah.
Because this is the best way to combat genocide, denial.
Mate, you summed that up perfectly. That's the best way to snuff them out, kill the memory. But in saying that, they haven't killed the memory of the Pondians because they have thrived and survived, and most of the influential Greeks out there in the world have got
Pondian ancestors. A lot of them are, yeah, very much so. For me, one of the greatest Greeks alive today is Milesanidis. Being a good Ayak boy, I have to say this.
Yeah.
But when you guys go to Greece, I was there in February.
Yeah.
You must visit Hagia Sophia, even if you're not an Ayak fan. Mm. And I feel sorry if you're not.
I was actually fortunate enough to spend some time with Ayak a few years ago for work. So
nice, very nice.
but also visited Baok as well.
Hang on, so you're not a Bazyanin fan.
Bazyanin is always my first team.
Yeah, good.
It's home.
Yeah.
But so let's be honest, Bazyanin will never play in Europe. Bazyanin will never win a title. So let's be honest.
Okay, so tell us about this stadium now. So it's called Hagia Sophia.
Officially it's called Bap Arena, but unofficially everybody calls it Hagia Sophia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is quite deliberate.
Mm.
Named after Hagia Sophia Konstantinopoli, which most people don't know or don't remember that Hagia Sophia Konstantinopoli, the design of it, there's actually three of them. The biggest one, the most famous one, is Sofia Konstantinopoli.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly a scale model, much smaller, is Hagia Sophia Nikaia, or Iznik today, its modern name, and Hagia Sophia Trapezunda.
Mm. Were they all on the same site, or is today?
They're both, all three are still standing. All three are mosques.
Okay, where are they?
One is in the town of Nikaia, which is about 100 kilometers from Konstantinopoli, in Asia Minor, and the other one's in Pontos, in Trapezunda.
Mm-hmm. Still standing.
It's a scale model, much smaller than Konstantinopoli, but exactly the same designs. They're about, the one in, I'm not sure about Nikaia, but the one in Trapezunda is about 500 years younger.
Mm. I went, as you know, well now, I've backpacked all through Europe, Middle East, and I did end up in Turkey. And I was at a youth hostel, and I met this Irish guy who was a lecturer and so forth. And he knew the history inside out of Hagia Sophia and the wall and Byzantine. So it was a perfect person to be with to go in and see Hagia Sophia. So we went in and he used to point things out and it blew me away. He's like you. He rattled off all this stuff and just I couldn't retain it all. But one thing I do remember, and I haven't been able, I should Google it. When Hagia Sophia got built, then I think it was Ahmed, the guy that built the Blue Mosque. So
Suleiman
Ahmed.
So that's why it's called the Suleimania, the Blue Mosque. Its nickname is the Blue Mosque.
Okay.
It's the Suleimania Mosque is the official name.
Okay. So 1,000 years later, so 530-odd AD they built it. I think it was 1500s when they built the Blue Mosque.
Suleiman the Magnificent was 1500s.
So what he told me was that they tried to copy Hagia Sophia. He got his best architects, best engineers.
Who was also Greek.
Was he?
Pelomazoma. Okay. Sinan, the architect, was from Cappadocia.
Okay. So the story he told me was they tried to build something bigger and better 1,000 years later. And when the Suleiman, or whatever his name was, Ahmed.
The Sultan.
Sultan at the time. He was only a young kid. He was in his 20s or something like that. Yeah. He went in, he saw it, and he was pissed off because it wasn't as beautiful. I think it was the open space. It wasn't. He didn't have that open space that Hagia Sophia had. And he beheaded someone. Is that true?
I couldn't tell you, to be honest. Okay. I'll go with this Irish specialist.
Yeah, he was a lecturer.
I've heard this story too.
Have you? Actually, yeah. Someone's head rolled.
It wasn't the architect, because Sinan did work for him afterwards. It would have been the engineer.
Okay. They couldn't build something bigger and better 1,000 years later. When I say bigger and better, the inside was had this open space where I did go to the Blue Mosque as well, and you had these massive columns
to support the roof. Yeah.
Yeah, correct. And it wasn't as open space. Mm. And 1,000 years later, they couldn't come up with anything better. So that's what blew me away, how advanced these people were.
Even today, Hagia Sophia is the second biggest church in existence. Although it's functioning as a mosque. There's only one that was built in the 1990s that is bigger.
Is that the St. Basilica in Rome?
No, it's a place in the Ivory Coast in Africa.
I thought, really? The Vatican is bigger than this.
No.
Really?
No, the Vatican's smaller. The St. Peter's Basilica Rome fits inside Hagia Sophia and then some.
Really?
Yeah. In terms of floor space, it's much smaller.
Sorry to digress, but don't digress because this goes,
and I will show you why you're not digressing. This is why in the new passports of the Republic, Hagia Sophia is on the pages. It's like a watermark.
So the Republic of what?
The Turkish Republic.
Okay.
All right. This is why, if you listen to his election announcements, Hagia Sophia is his greatest achievement. Erdogan considers Hagia Sophia's reconversion to a mosque his greatest achievement of 20 years of rule.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
You've got to think in terms of a legacy, in terms of who has, and the phrase he constantly uses is, I broke Hagia Sophia's chains.
Okay.
To have it as a museum or a church is to chain this building. The irony for me, San Panayotis, is you're talking about a church which even you call the Hagia Sophia Chami, the Hagia Sophia Mosque. So,
is that what Chami means? Mosque.
Chami is mosque. Yeah. Hang on, your mosque is named after a Christian, not a Christian saint, but in terms of Orthodox holy wisdom, there's two Hagia Sophias. There's Hagia Sophia to Theou, which is Konstantinopoli, and Hagia Sophia the saint, the person. And every time you bow down to Allah, you've got Christos Pantokratoras mosaic looking at you from up on the ceiling of the building.
Yeah.
I love the irony. This is one of the reasons I love history. I love irony.
Yeah, effectively, you're praying in a church.
You're bowing before God, before the Orthodox, before the Christian God. Jesus. I mean, it's just hilarious. But this is your greatest achievement. And this is why I have to bring it back to where we started this part of the conversation. This is why Hagia Sophia, this is why the Ajax Stadium was called Hagia Sophia, because Ajax, as you know, is Athletiki Enosi Konstantinopoliton. The people from Constantinople are the ones who founded the organization. Next year is its centenary.
Wow.
So there's a podcast for next year.
Yeah. So tell us about the stadium, because I know you did touch on it when we had a coffee.
The museum, the stadium is a museum. It's not a football ground. It's a museum.
It's got to be the most beautiful and unique stadiums in the world. Honestly,
if it doesn't win the Stadium of the Year award for 2023, 2022, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
All right.
What's the capacity?
About 30,000 for Greek football. It's a good size.
Yeah, that's
absolutely.
It's a good size stadium. We don't have the population for one of the Maracanã, you know, massive ones.
Oaka's empty most of the time, anyway. When Ajax plays there, whoever plays there,
and barely the Ethniki can fill it up.
Did Greece play Ireland recently?
So last week they played 2-1 over Ireland.
Did they play that stadium?
Oaka. No, they played at Hagia Sophia. Yes, they played at Hagia Sophia.
Yeah.
So each one of the gates to the, it's not, it's got gate 1, gate 2, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But each one of those gates is named after a city of Asia Minor or Pontus.
Really? Wow.
Not only is it named next to the gate, you've got some photos, some quotes, something, a list of cities of that region. So the whole stadium is a museum. Now, what they're finishing off now is a museum of people, the Prosvikou Hellenismo, Eastern Hellenism, which will be on one, underneath the bleachers, underneath the seats on one side.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, next to the merchandise shop.
Yeah.
Come on, you can't. Spaceballs, come on. One of the greatest films ever.
Yeah.
One of the greatest films of all time. Will be at the Museum of AIK, of the club.
Mm.
Hopefully in time for next year's centenary. So you've got two museums. Mm-hmm. You, just a couple of weeks ago, they inaugurated the chapel. There's actually a chapel inside the stadium.
Wow. How good's that? What's the chapel called?
It's dedicated to Iyo Sophia.
There you go.
All right. Out the front, the main, especially for the young ones, the main Insta photo spot,
yep,
is the double-headed eagle.
That's unbelievable.
Of AIK, but it's a sculpture. It's not a just an image. It's a full-on sculpture with the crown, with the orb and its claws. It's stunning.
Is that a symbol of Byzantine or is it Constantinople?
That's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
Constantinople's original name was Byzantio. The term Byzantine is an English invention.
Mm.
The people of Constantinople never called themselves Byzanti.
Mm.
They were Romni. The people of Constantinople today still call themselves Romni.
Mm.
We are the Christian Romans. We're not the pagan Greeks.
Mm.
This is where it came from.
But technically, it was the Roman Empire, wasn't it?
The Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Once the West collapsed, it became the Roman Empire,
which was Greek, run by Greeks. Well, not really.
Came to be at the beginning.
It was mixed. Yeah.
The last Latin-speaking emperor, and here's another one of the ironies, was Justinian, the guy who built Hagia Sophia.
Oh, really?
He was the last Latin-speaking emperor. His first language was Latin, not Greek.
Mm, okay.
His wife was Theodora. She was Greek-speaking.
Mm.
But everyone afterwards was all Greek-speaking.
Yeah.
Even the ones who were not ethnically Greek.
Yeah.
We have Armenians who were emperors.
So what did the two-headed eagle represent? Was that facing east and west?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
The Romans, you had their eagle as their standard of their legions, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The biggest disgrace for a Roman soldier was to lose the standard in battle.
Mm-hmm.
Better to lose your life than to lose your standard.
Mm.
So when Constantinople became the capital, with Constantino, this is why it became Constantinople, he was a very modest man. He named it after himself.
Yeah.
Hey, Alexander was better.
He named everything after himself.
Alexander did it 23 times. There are 23 cities called Alexandria.
Okay.
Only one of them is still called Alexandria in Egypt. But there are cities as far as Afghanistan, which started as Alexandria. But they're still cities today, but they've changed their names. I've lost the plot now.
That's okay. Two-headed eagle.
Two-headed eagle is because the Roman eagle was one-headed.
Yep.
Two-headed eagle is looking both east and west, as you said.
Mm.
And the Pontians also have a one-headed eagle as their symbol, always facing west to Constantinople.
Okay.
Because they were the frontiersmen.
Mm.
Just like the Russians had the Cossacks, they were the border guards, the tough, the Suliotes of the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
The Pontians were that on the eastern front of the empire, of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
So their eagle always faces west. Or when you're looking just at a flag, it looks left.
Yeah. Wow. So the Pontians, couldn't snuff them out. They've just grown and evolved. So where to now with the Pontians?
See, for me, the most amazing thing about the Pontians, and I'm not Pontian, by the way.
I'm a Gujarati. I think we've worked that out.
Just thought I'd remind everybody.
Yeah. Where are you from again? No. Go on.
This awesome place.
in our parts, we say, "And the benepsis to spiti su, ta pesna se plakosi."
Exactly.
Nice.
Exactly.
It's an old saying.
Translate that in English.
If you don't praise your own home, it will fall on your head.
Perfect.
I love it.
So if we don't mention Ipiro at least 5 times a minute, something's wrong with me.
We're going to start having a count. I was thinking about this the other day. There's going to be a count and effectively a swear jar for every time I mention Corfu and you mention Ipiro. We're going to be out of a job.
Whatever money you make from the podcast, we'll go into the jar.
Yeah. Jeez.
Be well over that, mate.
Studio.
Here's the most interesting thing about the four subsets of the Eastern Hellenism.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The Pontians are the only ones that are really thriving. You think about Asia Minor identity. Yes, they've got the music and the food, but as an identity, it's kind of faded. The same with Thraciotes, they've really been absorbed by what is left of Thrace under Greek control. Cappadocius, except for a few villages around Kavala, not an identity. the Ponyans are thriving.
Mm.
And I'll tell you what do I define by thriving. We have a number of Ponyan groups in Australia. We have a Federation of Ponyan Associations of Australia with, I call her the fearless leader. The new president a few weeks ago is Esther Pascalidi-Hila. She hates being called fearless leader. That's why I love calling her. That's why I say it. Not only do we have these clubs, we've got lots of different clubs. We've got the Pirotiko Club.
Mm-hmm.
They have folkloric groups.
Yep.
I can only talk really about one of them, the one that I'm associated with, Pondok Sniteas.
Mm.
Half the group are not Pondians.
Oh, right.
But they love it. They will put on the costumes for the national days. They will perform whenever they're called to. They will rock up and they love performing because they're show-offs. I don't know if either of you were in a dance group, but I was. If you're in a dance group, you're a born show-off. Just accept it. So that aspect of their culture is thriving.
Mm.
And what their brilliant teacher, Cristina Ioanidou, is doing with them, she's making them actually learn some of the songs that go with the dances.
Mm.
She's teaching them a little bit about why these dances are done by the boys and these are by the girls.
Mm.
And boys should never perform these dances ever because they're for girls.
Mm.
They were designed, they were created for feminine. It goes even further now, just this week.
Mm.
We have one group of them. One boy is from Kalymno, one boy is from Kriti, and one boy is part from part Pondian. Released an album in Sydney of Pondian music. They're all Australian born.
Yeah.
Children, grandchildren of the grandchildren of migrants from Greece. Not even children, they're the grandchildren of migrants. 20-somethings.
Mm.
But they're making Pondian music in Australia.
Fantastic. The legacy is still alive and beating, and it's and
this
vibrant.
Is, this is that vibrant, that reimagination constantly. That's what is live.
Mm, love it. Well done.
Yeah.
They can't speak Pondian, but they're performing the music. Mm. They can sing. And this is at least one aspect of that culture that is...
Yeah, well, they're still embracing it for how many years, you know, throwing genocide, everything, but not...
But to sum it all up then, what this really comes down to is the fact that there were attempts to eradicate them, but the opposite has happened in a lot of respects.
With the Pondians, yes. I mean, even today, you will hear these music, you will hear this language being spoken in Pondos. Now, one thing we didn't talk about was the crypto-Christians.
Mm.
We constantly hear reports about people who live in that region who, in secret amongst themselves, are Christians, still practice some sort of Christianity. Can't prove it. But there are constantly these stories coming out.
Wow. In the Pondus region,
they
call them crypto-Christians.
Yep.
So
unbelievable.
During the day.
Especially up in the mountains. No, today, 2023.
So they come out, join the community, they pretend they're Muslim, but they're not.
The whole world considers them Muslim.
Okay. But then they go back in.
But inside, in their own homes, typically in the cellars.
Yeah.
They have shrines. They do whatever they can, whatever they are able to practice as Christians.
Well, that's a story for another day, I think.
It has to be.
It's got to be.
It has to be.
Well, look, I think we've gone well over time, but we've barely scratched the surface, and it really does feel like that this time.
I feel like you're right.
There's so much more to cover with this, and we went as far back as the Minoans and earlier. We've gone through to the genocide. We've gone all over the map in that region. And where we went to Hagia Sophia, even the new stadium. Nick, I mean, I don't know how to wrap it all up. All we can say really is, Panayoti, thank you so much for being here.
My honour, please. And seriously.
Thank you, mate. And look, we will most definitely be having you back to talk about something. Maybe there's a part two to this. There probably will be, I would suspect.
There could be.
We definitely tried to get as much stories out there as we have through the genocide. But look, we did go off on tangents. But it's all quality, interesting stuff. And even... me and you, Tomo, I could see the way you're nodding. We learned so much out of that.
Well, one of the big things I talk about, not... I mean...
The croissant.
No, the thing about babula.
Oh, babula. Yeah, far out.
And that's the most, sort of rudimentary thing. We learned so much out of this discussion and so much has come to light for us, you know, and particularly for me who doesn't know probably as much as I should about this. Everyone is going to take something out of this, I think.
I hope so.
And they'll pick up a book because of it. Or do a search to say, that's an interesting part of that discussion that I want to find more about. And that's what this podcast is about. So, again, Panayoti, thank you so much for being here, mate.
Thank you for the invitation. And what you just said is why I accepted the invitation.
Mm. Well, I think you've done
to trigger thought, to trigger a conversation.
Yeah. You've certainly done that.
definitely, mate.
Starting with us, and I think ending with our audience.
Yeah, surely. Definitely. Look, thank you so much, and we are going to have you on again. We did touch on, I think, in our discussion, Alexander the Great, mm-hmm. or Epiro, or the Soliotes. So we're going to cover some of those. So any
let's do all of them.
Any listeners
there
out there?
They're actually connected, because a lot of people forget Alexander's mother was an Epirotissa.
That's right.
Queen Olympias.
From Thesprotia.
Let's not go there.
Come on, mate. Give me that. Listeners out there, if you want to tell us what you want to hear. So hopefully we answered some of those questions for those people that wrote in and wanted to hear about the Pondians and the genocide. Otherwise, tell us what you want to hear next. Is it Alexander the Great? Is it Soliotes? Is it the Epirotides? Or anything else?
And apologies if we haven't covered a portion of this that definitely. We should have, because, again, this is a massive topic, and we can't hope to cover it even. I mean, we're well over 2 hours now, but we can't hope to cover it in that amount of time. Pick up a book. Watch the documentaries. Make sure you do your own research on it as well.
Good comments, Tom. Well,
Nick, uzotalk@outlook.com is the email. Make sure you are sending us your feedback, as Nick's just said as well. Let us know what you want to hear next, but also follow us on social media @UzoTalk and @Uzo_talk on Instagram. Nick Athanasiou, thank you very much, mate.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Thank you, everyone.
See you later.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.